When they're not broadcasting, the ACBRI DJs are hard at work creating personal web pages about their shows, the music they play, and even a little bit about themselves. And you can visit these web pages by going to the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring. To check out the web ring, go to interactive.acbradio.org, then choose the link for the web ring. You can view a site at random, or you can look at a list of all the websites in the ring. So if you want to learn more about the personalities behind the microphone, go to interactive.acbradio.org and check out the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring.
Don't risk the disappointment of missing a great ACB radio program. Join our announcements list today. Receive email about upcoming programs on all our channels and new features. To join, send a blank email now to announce-subscribe at acbradio.org. That's announce-subscribe at acbradio.org. Or visit our website. Announcements about ACB radio delivered to you direct and free. Just another way to stay in touch with ACB radio.
ACB Radio.
The following is an ACB Radio mainstream exclusive. Mark Hotel in Houston, Texas. ACB Radio Mainstream brings you coverage of the 41st Convention of the American Council of the Blind. Now, here's Jonathan Mosen.
And a very good morning to you from Houston, Texas. It is Wednesday, July the 3rd today, and we're pleased to be back with you for more coverage of the ACB National Convention. Last night over on ACB Radio Interactive, with astounding numbers, we were all listening to the Friends and Art Showcase of Talent, and in listening back to that stream, we weren't getting much audience sound during the performances, but I can certainly tell you that the place was really rocking, even though it's sometimes difficult to hear that was the case. There was a very big crowd in here, and they were all singing along, and particularly to those last Queen tracks that were done by Dave Wilkinson, who did a fantastic job with that. Oh gosh, it's probably inappropriate to single anyone out really, because there were just so many fantastic acts. Having said that, I've got to say, yeah, Greg Brayton was fantastic as always. Mika White, of course, with her Black Velvet song. I've never heard Mika sing before. And a number of other really great performances. So that's the Friends and Art Showcase of Talent. We will make what we could get of it available for modem users when we get back and start putting the archives together a little further. But for those people who are really keen, we are in the process of uploading the 128 kbps stream to our FTP site, but what we will probably do in the long term is just make a modem stream available of it, because we were unable in the end to get a stereo stream of the feed last night. Let's tell you about what is going to happen today. A very interesting mixture of programming for the convention today. The entertainment that you can hear is coming from Karen Eatle of Houston, Texas. At 8:30 we will begin. The person who's presiding today, I guess after some formal business is conducted, is Donna Sellinger from Des Moines in Iowa, and she's the secretary of the American Council of the Blind. There will be an invocation from Bishop Craig Lundell. He's of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, based here in Houston in Texas. Following that, we'll have another Talking Signs giveaway. And although various commitments have prevented me from getting round to the exhibits this year for Main Menu, I did have a very brief wander around yesterday so I could get my hands on a pack mate and make sure I got some NBP books for my kids and that sort of thing. And I use the talking signs to get around the place. And although there's lots of fluorescent lighting around, which is affecting the signal to some extent, and there's a lot of crackle going on, it was really quite liberating. I have never felt so able to get around exhibits completely independently in a productive way, to just get around there and hear what it is that you're by. I smell breakfast. I'm going to run through the program now. So that's pretty impressive, and the Talking Sign giveaway continues this morning. There'll be some ACB business between 8:40 and 9:15. No doubt there'll be some resolutions coming through, and perhaps some constitution and bylaws amendments. Now, 9:15, something that is promising to be popular. What your audible pedestrian signal should tell you. Dr. Bethy Bentz of Boston, Massachusetts, will be talking about that. Standards for audible pedestrian signalling are certainly under discussion. At 9:40 a.m., we will hear about the Sound Alert Locator System. And to tell us about that, we will have Professor Deborah Wington, who is a neuroscientist from Leeds University, and most importantly of all, an Archers fan. This is extremely important. We've been having a chat about the Archers and catching up. She's from Leeds University, and also she's joined by John Fenner of the UK. At 10 o'clock, and of course these times are approximate, talking TVs and phones you can use. We will be hearing about that important subject from Jennifer Simpson. Jennifer is from the Federal Communications Commission Consumer Information Bureau in Washington, D.C. That will take us to a break, which is scheduled to occur at about 10:30 this morning for 15 minutes. And then we hear about another vital subject, new ideas for idea reauthorization. For those people listening to us, and we have a lot of people outside the states listening to us, IDEA is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and is a critical piece of legislation. And to facilitate this discussion, we will have Susan Crawford of Silver Spring, Maryland. Then at 11:15, the wizardry of narrating. It's one of the most popular items of presentation on the convention every year, when a talking book narrator is brought in to talk about their experience, how it all works, narrating talking books. And we hear a voice that is familiar to many Americans. And today, it's Eric Sandvold. Now, I believe that he narrates the Harry Potter books. I may be wrong, because of course I don't get to access a lot of US material, so I could stand corrected, but I believe that's the case. He's of Talking Book Publishing in Denver, Colorado. There's a nice big slot for him to take us to 11:55, when we will have some announcements, and you never know, perhaps we'll adjourn at midday. So that's what's happening this morning. I'm going to switch you through to the entertainment and let you get a feel for that, and also remind you that you can contact us at convention@acbradio.org. I'm going to fire up the MSN Messenger in just a second, and you can also use email. Although I'm unable to respond to email, I am getting it. I've been getting some very interesting email. One person who I'm not sure if I should name them or not, but a very interesting message from them who indicated that she was a Federationist. She has been for some years. She's listening to the ACB convention. I think it's the first time in a wee while that there hasn't been an absolute clash of dates. She says she's enjoying the scholarships and the discussion about education in Texas, but she did feel that Joanne Wilson should have been treated with a little more respect. She felt that some of the treatment was disrespectful, and that whether we're Federationists or not, that it's important that all blind advocates be treated with some respect and respected for what they're achieving. She said that she, as a Federationist, has spoken to an ACB convention in her professional capacity, not a full convention, but perhaps an ACB meeting, I should say. So it was a very thought-provoking message, and I thank you for sending it in. And of course, this is one of the things about ACB Radio. It can bring an ACB convention to a group of people who may not necessarily attend, or who may even attend as a result of what they hear. So I certainly appreciate the feedback. 21 minutes past 8 Central Time now, and we'll patch it through to the music ahead of the 8:30 beginning of the general session.
Is Jeff Tom in the room? Jeff, if you're in the room, please come to the head table.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Is that six? 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, it's not six. Keep counting.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2.
Well, he's just got him reversed. Thank you.
1234, 123, 12, hello, 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 123.
They are not. They're over in the convention office. Is that Marjorie asking for them?
Three, 1 2 1 2 1 2.
Good morning, everybody. We're ready to go, Chris. Karen Lundell on the piano.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we can come to order this morning, starting our Wednesday proceedings, thank you all very much for being here. Let us begin by giving a warm round of applause to Karen Eitel from Houston, Texas, for our entertainment today.
Morning. How are you, sir?
I'm getting the impression that we are missing some speakers, which would be on the right-hand side of the hall. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. We're working on it, and we'll have it dealt with. You know, when our friends in art come in on Tuesday night, it does funny things to Wednesday morning. And we're on it, and thank you for letting us know. Ladies and gentlemen, if I could at this time for the invocation for Wednesday morning, introduce to you Bishop Craig Lundell from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's from Houston, Texas, and he's here today to give us the invocation. Reverend Lundell.
Our Father who art in heaven,
We humbly bow our heads before thee this morning and give thee thanks for the many blessings which we enjoy in this life. We give thee thanks for life itself and for the opportunities and experiences which it affords us. We're especially grateful this day for this conference, for the American Council of the Blind, and the opportunities that it provides the members here to learn new things and to make friends and to make plans that will help them in their lives and help others similarly situated. Father, we pray thy Spirit to be with us that we might go forth from this meeting uplifted and having gained knowledge and understanding and having made new friends and acquaintances. We ask you to help us that we might help others and improve their lives. And we ask thee that thy Spirit might be with us to comfort us always and guide us and protect us. And we say these things in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Chris?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you.
Bishop Lundell, thank you so much for coming to ACB this morning. Okay. Now let's, Ed Bradley, are you here?
Yes.
Ed, I'll recognize you for the drawing of the first prize of the day, the reward for getting here on time, the talking sign giveaway for today.
Get on. We have a $50 prize.
What? No. First thing to do is the talking sign giveaway.
Mr. President.
Pam Shaw.
The information booth.
Pam Shaw is the winner. And Pam has worked so hard for us this week. She probably didn't know what the heck she was getting into when she took that information desk.
Hello. Mr. President.
Yes, who calls for the floor?
You're going to be surprised.
I think I am.
Yeah, I think
so. Is that Walter?
You found out yesterday. I'm sorry you didn't find out before. But I just wanted to say real quick, I know a lot of people might have heard about the fact that I was got up here and I didn't come to the convention. It looked like I came to go in the hospital. However, I am out, I'm back, and I heard a lot of people around praying for me, and I want to thank them all because somebody's prayers got answered.
Well, thank you for coming back.
Now, I just want to say one more thing, by the way. If
yes,
anybody
Walter.
Is looking for two tickets for tonight's show, I got a cell phone. Just call upstairs and tell my wife. And,
Mr. President.
And she'll hold them for you.
All right. Thanks, guys, very much. And, Walter, welcome back. We're so happy to have you.
Well, I'm glad
Mr.
to make
President.
It back a part
of it. Who's the lady calling for the floor?
I can't stop it. This is Darian Hartman on the floor.
Yes, Darian.
There is so much background conversation.
Yes, I know. But the problem is, Darian, that half the audience doesn't have speakers right now. All the microphones on one side are out, and it creates quite a bit of confusion. We are working on it, and this side that is on, frankly, sounds kind of pretty distorted to me, too. But we're working on it, but we need to move on. I'm very mindful, ladies and gentlemen, that there was a lot of disgruntlement and unhappiness that we ran over yesterday. We couldn't help it, as you know, too, and I know you understand that. We're going to try very hard to stay on time today. I know. All right. Whoever did that, thank you. We want to stay on time today if we can, and I want to tell you right now, I'm going to tell you this so Donna doesn't have to later on. Today, when we have questions and answers, we're going to have no more than three questions for any one speaker. I'm sorry to do that. I know that you want to ask questions and talk to people, and it's your only opportunity. But we also have got to get you out of here for the lunches. We have to get people out of here for the tours, and I know you want that too.
Mr. President,
if you would be so kind as to be patient with us about that, three questions per speaker. We just can't do any more today. We have too much to take care of. Remember, tonight at 6 p.m. There's a speaker's reception at 1068, and you bring your burning questions there, and in most cases, you'll find your questions are answered. I know that we had some trouble with that last night, but there won't be any tonight. 1068 at 6 p.m. for the speaker's reception. Kathy, you called for the floor?
Yes, I did. First of all, there's some confusion about the California breakfast. It's for California members. It's in Richmond 2 and 3 in the morning at 7 a.m.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how many are going to be there. I need to know who's taking charge of that project now that Terry is away. And I need help from everybody in this room. I have some tickets for some prizes for some musical things, Manlo albums and many, many other things. And I can't go through them now because we don't have the time. But I would like and appreciate it very much if one person from each state, like the president, for example, would ask your people if you'd like to have a dollar ticket to win some fabulous prizes. You don't have to be present to win. And I would appreciate it if you can do that, if you could call 974, because Derwood yes. McDaniel also was a very fine person. We're trying to do something with him. But, Chris, could we just announce, or could I now, that the two winners of the Derwood K. McDaniel first-timers were Eric Fry from Kentucky and Mike Halley from Minnesota, and we have got some fine people here. They're great.
Okay, thank you very much, Kathy. I have an announcement. The D.C. Maryland Caucus will take place on Thursday at 2 p.m. in the Executive Director's Suite. That's room 1062. The D.C. Maryland Caucus, tomorrow, 2 p.m., Executive Director's Suite, 1062. Okay, I will now recognize Jerry Annunzio for a brief announcement.
I mean, I'm not even going to sell anything yet, except ACB. In the Houston Chronicle, on the front page of the Metropolitan section, we have a really nice little article, and I think that needs to be recognized, on massage parlor, P-A-W-L-A-L-O-R. That's it. Thanks, Chris.
Great. Thanks very much. Yeah, they said they were going to come out for that doggy massage. Well, okay, and you know, while we're talking about that, I'm really happy to tell you that, you know, yesterday I announced that we were on the AP National Wire, not just the state wire, but the National Wire. Also yesterday, besides that, ACB was featured on CNN. I really want to thank Ralph Sanders and the PR committee. You can see what work they've done and they are doing. It's great. I would now like to recognize the chair of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee, Ray Campbell, and he's going to present to you some of the amendments that we've had readings of before today. Ladies and gentlemen, Ray Campbell.
All right. Ooh, back off of that a little bit. Good morning, everyone. Well, now we actually get to vote on something, ladies and gentlemen. What I would like to do this morning, on Monday I read to you the first reading of an amendment which establishes as a standing committee in the American Council of the Blind a public relations committee, and we will now read that amendment again, and this is the time that we can debate that and vote on that. And just one quick second, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
Starting on Braille page 47, amend bylaw 6 by adding a new section L to the end of the bylaw. Proposed wording, L. A public relations committee is hereby created, which shall have the responsibility of promoting and enhancing the public image of the American Council of the Blind through the publication of press releases and the implementation of public relations campaigns on targeted issues. The committee shall consist of 9 members, which shall include a chair appointed by the president, the chair of the board of publications, a member chosen from among the 3 elected members of the board of publications elected by that body, 2 additional members appointed by the president, and 1 member elected from among the board of directors by that body at its post-convention board meeting each year. In addition, the committee shall have 3 ex officio members who shall not have the right to vote. These shall be the executive director of the American Council of the Blind or his or her designee, the webmaster of the American Council of the Blind, and the director of ACB Radio. The Public Relations Committee shall operate under the aegis of the Board of Publications, and the chair of the Public Relations Committee shall serve as an ex officio member of the Board of Publications. Appointments to the Public Relations Committee shall be made within 60 days from the end of each convention of the American Council of the Blind. At meetings of the Public Relations Committee, the chair shall not have the right to vote unless the vote of the chair is necessary to break a tie. The Constitution and Bylaws Committee recommends a do pass, and I so move.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, you've heard the motion of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee, and it has been duly seconded. I would like, as we begin the discussion on this matter, to recognize 2 people. And these 2 people are the primary people who crafted the ideas and came together with all their thoughts and presented and worked out with the Constitution and Bylaws Committee a final version of this. And I'd like to give them each an opportunity to say a few words about it, and then we'll have some debate. To begin with this, I'd like to recognize Paul Edwards from Florida and the immediate past president of ACB.
Thank you. Hello. Good. Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, I created the Public Relations Committee about a year and a half ago. And in the year and a half since it's been in existence, the Public Relations Committee has accomplished a lot. I think that by creating it as an ad hoc committee, I made a mistake. It should have, in fact, been created as a standing committee from the beginning. And my feeling is that when you make a mistake, you ought to try to make it better. And so I crafted a constitutional amendment, or a bylaw amendment, which I presented to the Constitution and Bylaws Committee on Saturday. And then on Sunday, met with Ralph Sanders, who had also had the same idea as I had and had crafted one of his own. And we attempted to take the best of both of our constitutional amendments and put them together in order to create what we believe is a fair and balanced approach to the creation of a public relations committee that clearly operates as an element of the Board of Publications. What this constitutional and bylaw amendment does is to create a balanced approach which makes the chair of the Board of Publications a member of the Public Relations Committee and also makes the chair of the Public Relations Committee an ex officio member of the Board of Publications. As a result, we feel that the communication that needs to occur between the Public Relations Committee and the Board of Publication and an assurance that the policies of ACB will continue to be carefully looked at by the Board of Publication at the same time as giving the Public Relations Committee the freedom to do the things that it needs to do in order to get press releases out there and in order to continue to publicize what ACB is doing is protected by this amendment. And so I would urge that we adopt this bylaw amendment.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'd like now to recognize Ralph Sanders.
I'm waiting for this mic to... I'm live. All right.
There it is.
Good morning, Mr. President and fellow members. We're glad to see that notwithstanding the proposed bylaw amendment, that our press relations efforts have been a success at this convention. We recognize that the higher we raise the bar, you'll expect nothing less than full coverage on all three networks in Pittsburgh next year, and we'll do our best to deliver. We too had, as Paul indicated, had brought an amendment along the same lines, and we got together and did some good old-fashioned Arkansas-Florida horse trading and came up with what I think is a workable solution. One of the difficulties that grew out of Paul's response to my recommendation back in 1999 to in 2000 to establish a public relations committee was to create some confusion and sometimes having people left out of the loop who needed to be in the loop. And I learned early on, well, late on Saturday afternoon, that past President Edwards had, in fact, submitted a proposal that I was told went along the lines of that of the Public Relations Committee. There were some differences in numbers. I've tended to recommend larger committees than most committees in the ACB on the notion that the public relations process needs to be as diverse and extensive as possible across this country. But I also recognize that that I made an error in attempting to do that, in that it makes it difficult to make sure everybody's involved in the communication. And as Paul just said, we sincerely believe that by putting this amendment into place, we will enable ourselves to go forward with even more planned public relations efforts than we've been able to do here, do them better, and do them with more collaborativeness, more communication, and more participation on a broad base. Ultimately, public relations is about communication, and as the old wise saying goes, communication starts at home. I, too, recommend the passage of the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ralph. All right, we have this motion on the floor to adopt. Do we have any questions, any requests for clarification? What's your pleasure?
Yeah, I would spit. There you go. Hi, it's Charlie Crawford. Rather than introducing a perfecting amendment, as it were, I'd just like to create a legislative history to this amendment. I think we all agree that news releases, whether originating from the National Office or the Public Relations Committee, would be shared contemporaneously with each other so that nobody's surprised. Do we all agree with that?
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay, so we don't really have to have an amendment, just get it in the notes, minutes, right?
No.
No what?
We don't need to.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye.
Mr. President.
Yes, I think that might be Jim Eccles from Washington.
It might. It is. I'll save you the guesswork.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think conceptually this amendment is a very fine idea. I think there are only two problems with it. Number one, it's doing something that already been done, and I don't think any president would revoke the Public Relations Committee unless he wanted to resign early. Number two, this amendment tells us everything except for when to breathe in and when to breathe out. It's awfully convoluted to say let's have a committee. So I think it's a fine idea, but the next time we let Polly and Ralphie go in a room together, somebody needs to go in with them to make sure that they don't craft something that collapses by its own weight. This amendment wasn't crafted, it was conceived, and I bet it had a gestation period. It's just too complicated.
You know, I think the gestation period was about a year and a half, actually.
Mr. Chairman,
who's calling for
this? Which is the same as that for an elephant.
Just as clarification from this is Chair Reiki,
yes,
the chair of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee. I wanted to just say to you that, without rendering an opinion, because I don't think the chair of the committee should do that, If you look at all of our other standing committee amendments, you will see that they are very, it very well spells out the kind of work that the committees do, and this is what this amendment, I believe, attempted to do. So it sounds complicated, certainly, Jim. I respect your feelings there. But if you look at the other parts of the Constitution and the rest of Bylaw 6, which deals with standing committees, you're going to see that the work of each committee and what it's supposed to do is quite well spelled out in much the same way as it is here.
Okay, thank you very much, Ray. Who else would like the floor?
Call the question.
I hear a desire to call the question. And I don't hear anybody really yelling to debate this anymore. All those in favor of this amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by saying nay.
Nay.
Motion carries. Ray, what do we have next?
Okay, I'll do one more. Let's take care of the other amendment that we read yesterday and get that taken care of at this time as soon as I find it. Okay. This is so nice when you've got electronic devices. You can just kind of click right down here and you can get to... Okay, here we go. Okay, the next amendment we're going to deal, this is one that I read to you yesterday, so it's time to read it, discuss it, and vote on it. Starting on Braille page 15, amend Article 4 of the Constitution by inserting a new Section O and relettering the succeeding sections. Proposed wording, O. Should a vacancy occur in the office of immediate past president, the vacancy shall not be filled by the Board of Directors. The office shall be allowed to remain vacant until such time as a successor shall be duly qualified to succeed into the office of immediate past president. That's the amendment, Mr. President. The Constitution and Bylaws Committee presents this amendment to the floor with no recommendation.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Who asked for the floor?
This is Charlie Hodge.
Charlie
Mr.
Hodge,
Chairman,
I recognize you if you wish to make a motion.
I would like to make a motion that the convention adopt the amendment.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Charlie, do you wish to discuss it or just make a motion?
I'll just say that the amendment, the current bylaw speaks in terms of the Board of Directors having the power to fill vacancies in elected positions on the Board of Directors and elected seats on the Board of Publications. The immediate past president position is not truly elected. It's by status. So, under the current bylaw, I think the proper interpretation would be that the Board of Directors should not fill a vacancy if it should occur in that position. But to make it clear to anyone, and the question has been asked of me, what would happen if that position did become vacant? I propose this simple two-sentence new section that would make clear what I think is the proper interpretation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The motion's been made and seconded.
Mr. President?
Who calls for the floor?
This is Dick Seifert.
Okay, Dick.
I would like to recommend a friendly amendment by dropping the words by the Board of Directors.
Dick, you're saying that
the vacancy shall not be filled.
Okay, shall not be filled. So you want to drop by the Board of Directors?
Yes.
I believe that the committee could regard that as friendly because in other places in the Constitution it states that how vacancies are filled. So I think we could.
Mr. President, if we have.
Okay, thank you. It's not that important.
I'm just trying to make sure I get everything deleted as I'm supposed to here. Okay. Vacancy shall not be filled. Oops, I got to do one more delete here.
Any further discussion?
Mr. President?
Charlie, I've already recognized you. Is there any other discussion?
Yes.
Mr. Thompson.
I hear one person who seemed to want to discuss it, and then we're going to call the question and move on.
Mr. President?
Yes?
This is Ron Freese from Ohio.
Yeah, Ron.
We have this situation in Ohio right now. And so we have a vacancy for immediate pass. And we felt that this position needed to be filled as far as to be able to give the current president, I guess, someone to go to that's been there and done that. And what we did was to ask the person that had that position formerly to sit in and fill in. Rather than leave that go vacant, we just felt that the president at times needed someone to turn to say, you know, has this ever happened before? And just someone for advice. So we felt that this position should be filled.
Okay.
And I think that maybe we need to take a look at that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, point of clarification.
Yes, Ray.
I just wanted to say that, to Ron's point, that would be very difficult. You have to. There's some other things in your Constitution that are going to have to be changed in order to accomplish filling this position, because it states elsewhere in the Constitution that the president succeeds into the position of immediate past president. So really, that's in the Constitution. That is the only way you can get an immediate past president into that position, is to allow the person to succeed into that position. So it's we would need to go back next year and take a look at a lot of things if we're going to ask that this position be filled. And like I said, it's pretty well states how this position is filled in the Constitution. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, thank you very much. The question's been called. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by saying nay.
No.
Motion carries. Ray, do you have any further amendments you wish to read this morning?
Do you want me to do any more, or do you want to go to resolutions? Or
if you need to read one today for us to consider tomorrow, but
sure.
If you want to wait till tomorrow, that's fine too.
I can read.
Okay.
I can read one more.
All right.
Okay. Let's see.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're not doing the best job we could of keeping order in the hall. Now, this talking that's going on out there, I can hear it up here. If I can hear it up here, I know it's disturbing others around you. Please do not talk.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to... This is the first reading of an amendment, so we do not discuss it today, of course. Starting on Braille page 46, amend Bylaw 6, Section K, in the third sentence, by inserting the words, or his or her designee, before the first occurrence of the word shall. Okay, let me read the current wording, and for context, it's a very long section. What I'm going to do is read the current wording of the first three sentences of the section, and then I will read the proposed wording. Let me read to you. Okay, Section K. There is hereby established a committee on advocacy services. The president and executive director shall serve as members of the committee. The president shall chair the committee, and the director of advocacy services shall serve as a non-voting member of the committee. The proposed wording, Section K. There is hereby established a committee on advocacy services. The president and executive director shall serve as members of the committee. The president or his or her designee shall chair the committee, and the director of advocacy services shall serve as a non-voting member of the committee. So that's the first reading of that one, and that's all I have to bring before you right now, Mr. President.
Jeff.
Jeff Tom.
Yeah. He's on the other side.
He's on the right.
Oh, he's on the other side. Oh, okay. Have you got a quick one you can do?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Ray. I was hunting for Jeff to see if we had a quick resolution, but I was hunting on the wrong side of the platform up here. thank you very much, Ray, and the committee. We'll now take at least probably only one resolution from the Resolutions Committee, and I recognize Jeff Tom.
Okay, it'll take me just a moment to dig this up. Thank you. In the meantime, we could consider
a door prize.
Hey, that'd be a good idea. Yes,
Ed Bradley. How about a door prize while Jeff is getting his resolution there? Okay.
50 dollars cash from the Badger Association of the Blind. Therese McCobb, Fremont, California.
Therese, are you here?
No, Therese.
I don't hear any shouts or anything.
Don Osborne, Indianapolis, Indiana. Don here?
No.
Well, he's got... Michael Benson, Brunswick, Georgia. Michael's here? Thank the Lord. Okay.
Where? All right.
Of course he's not.
Oh, he's not here either. Okay.
His wife's here.
Sorry, I wasn't here yesterday and didn't get one. Donald Coors, Indianapolis, Indiana. Thank the Lord.
All right, congratulations, Don.
One more?
Yeah.
Okay. No?
Yes.
That it?
Okay, thank you very much. I'll now turn the chair over to Jeff Tom.
Okay, the way we're going to conduct this, just so you know, when I'm up here is, since I am going to conduct the discussion, I will give the recommendation after I read it and ask for a motion from the floor. I will not make the motion itself. Okay, 2002-3, we're skipping two for right in the moment. Accessible materials, AARP. Whereas the population of Americans age 50 and over is growing at an ever-increasing rate, and whereas this population has a high incidence of vision loss, and whereas more than 80% of persons with visual impairments are seniors, and whereas... Whereas AARP is the largest organization of seniors in this country, and whereas a large number of AARP members are blind or visually impaired or experience vision loss, which results in their inability to read standard print, and whereas printed materials provided by AARP to its members, including Modern Maturity Magazine, the monthly publication of AARP, are not made available by AARP in formats accessible to people with vision impairments, and whereas, despite the pleas of blind and visually impaired individuals, AARP has given no indication that it will consider making these materials available in accessible formats, and whereas this discriminatory treatment results in a lack of equal access to membership benefits for blind and visually impaired AARP members, and whereas this omission also violates the spirit of the Americans with Disabilities Act and other disability rights laws, now therefore be it resolved by the American Council of the Blind in convention assembled this third day of July 2002 at the Adams Mark Hotel in Houston, Texas, that this organization demand that AARP its membership materials, including Modern Maturity Magazine, to its blind and visually impaired members in accessible formats, including Braille, large print, audio cassette, and computer disc. And be it further resolved that AARP is encouraged to promptly implement procedures necessary to comply with this resolution in order to avoid potential civil rights enforcement actions. And the committee recommends a due pass. There has been a motion and a second. Any discussion?
Discussion.
Well, there's a point of information. I'll
discussion.
Recognize that first.
Right, I under.
No, no, actually.
Mr. Chair, I'm the point of information.
Okay, go ahead.
James Eccles, Washington
yes,
State.
James.
Those of you who are about to be 50 may remember that some 30 years ago, Hadley School for the Blind published a news article montage magazine called the Hadley Focus, and it very often printed. Reprinted audio versions of articles from Modern Maturity, and so some of us may have actually read them. I think that would be a very, very good magazine to make generally available.
Okay, let me just respond. AARP is now, from what we've been given to understand, the official name. So that point is well taken, but it is actually not the case. We didn't spell it out intentionally.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Gene Sanders.
Okay, Gene, go ahead.
AARP is available on Talking Book on Interloan Library Service.
There are
currently.
We are informed that there are some libraries that are making it available, but that
you
the
can get it on interlibrary loan service.
You shouldn't have to do that.
Okay. There was a gentleman that wanted the floor.
Yes, John Harden, South Carolina. I would like to suggest in the sentence of accessible media, adding email. This would save AARP money and we get the material to people that can use it quickly and in whatever access of media that they would want. If it's in email, you can read it in Braille. Large print or whatever.
Sir, are you making that in the form of a motion?
I would like to make that as an amendment to the motion.
Okay, there is a motion that email be included. There has been a second. Is there a discussion? The question's been called. All those in favor of...
You have to vote on
it. It's just an amendment. We have to vote on it. We're voting on the amendment. No, I have heard no call for the floor, and I've started to conduct the vote. So we're going to vote on the amendment to... We are going to vote on the amendment to add email. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment carries. We will add email.
Hello. Oh, hi, Charlie. It's Michael.
Okay, now... We are going to, for the interest of time, and I think we've fleshed this discussion out fairly thoroughly. There is a point of order. That does take precedence.
You have no authority, as far as I know, to conduct motions. That has to be done by the presiding officer.
The chair, the president has requested that I do so.
I totally respect what you're saying. I have given Jeff permission to do this. And to tell you guys the truth, I've been asking people. I know we didn't do it with Ray this morning on that amendment regarding PR because we thought the debate had the potential to be contentious and so forth. And Ray asked me if I would take the chair on that. I want my committee chairs, in cases where there isn't some significant contention or difficulty, to be able to take the floor and run their business. I don't mind that.
Jeff, Tom?
I probably should have said that before, and thank you for standing up for my rights, but in this case, I don't mind.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
This is Charlie Crawford. Can you assure us that the provisions relative to enforceability as a civil rights law are... can we do that since they're a membership organization? I don't know that they can be compelled to do that.
That's why the resolution is stated in the manner that it is stated. I wouldn't give you an assurance, and the committee specifically stated in the resolution that it violates the spirit of those laws.
So in the advocacy effort to get this done, you're saying that we can use our best judgment with respect to how to do that?
Yes, Charlie, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. I believe that the discussion has concluded. The question has been called. All those in favor of Resolution 2002-3 say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The resolution has been passed.
Thank you very much, Jeff. A quick announcement. Several people have come to ask me about the tickets for the gathering this evening, the dinner at which Zha Yang will be there to answer questions and talk with people and meet people. You can get those tickets at the registration office. Okay? So please do. I look forward to having you there. And thanks very much for doing that. I would now like to turn the podium and the microphone over to the presiding officer of the day for our program, ACB's secretary. Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome, please, for Donna Seliger.
Thank you, President Gray. I'd like to tell you a little secret. I'm nervous. You know, When I was growing up, Wednesday was called hump day. You know, you get through Wednesday, you got it made. Well, in taking a look at our program, we got to Wednesday, and it's looking better and better all the time. Our program today is filled with informative and interesting speakers, and I think that we should start off right away with a very interesting topic. How about pedestrian safety and talking signs? Is our speaker here?
I hope so. Ask her if you approach the
front. Here she comes. Here she comes. Our first speaker of the day is Dr. Beezy Benson. She has been with us before, and she is going to talk to us about what our pedestrian signals should tell us. I give you now Beezy Benson. Please give her a warm welcome.
I can hardly tell you how pleased I am to be able to talk with you this morning. I have appreciated so much the support of the American Council of the Blind in the research that I do and for participating with me in advocacy efforts to make the environment more accessible for people with visual impairments. Our first real engagement together was in research on audible signs back when the convention was in San Francisco, and we were comparing talking signs and verbal landmark, both of which are audible signs that require a receiver. And we found that unquestionably an audible sign that was directional in its nature, an infrared sign, was much better than one that required just speech messages that had to tell you what compass direction you were going, or that relied on your knowing some landmarks in the environment that they could relate to. The next thing that you helped support, it wasn't done at a convention, but you helped support research that demonstrated unequivocally that curb ramps could be a problem to people with visual impairments. And that has resulted in the recognition in the draft guidelines for public rights of way that were released by the Access Board on June 17th, requiring detectable warnings at the bottoms of curb ramps. And that was research that you supported. The next thing that we did together was that you participated and helped to fund a survey to find out what problems visually impaired people had at intersections. Two of the problems that came out most strongly were that you often didn't know if there was a push button you needed to push, and if there was one, you couldn't find it. This has resulted in these draft guidelines that I mentioned requiring that push buttons have a locator tone, so that as you come to the corner, you know that you need to push a button and you can find it because the tone's coming from the push button. Another thing that came out of that survey was that there were lots of problems in knowing which crosswalk had the walk signal. Even if maybe it was a cuckoo or a chirp, there still were a lot of problems in knowing which crosswalk had the walk signal. And that has resulted in these guidelines and in language in the manual and uniform traffic control devices talking about the optimal location of accessible pedestrian signals. Putting them in the best places is better than any other way of indicating which crosswalk has the walk interval, much more important than what it sounds like. The next thing we did together was at a mid-year meeting in Los Angeles when you participated and supported some research on locator tones, and that established the repetition rate for locator tones that is now the national standard. And then the last thing we did most recently was last summer in Des Moines. You supported and participated outstandingly in research on the nature of speech messages. If an accessible pedestrian signal should have a speech message, what should that message be like? You have, between here and the Hilton, some accessible signals that have speech messages. Is there anybody here who has not used those? Let me tell you, that's an excellent technology. The manufacturer is Polara, and they are exhibiting here. However, I want to tell you about that particular installation. Next time you use it, I want you to think about it a little bit more specifically and reflect on it in light of what I'm going to say in the rest of my talk here. That, first of all, the messages are not the messages which came out to be the ones that are recommended as a result of the research that you all supported and participated in last summer. They're similar, but they're not quite there. I'll explain that as we get on into talking about the research, and you can think about next time you try those messages whether you would like it better if it came out according to the research that you participated in and supported last summer. Second of all, the volume is too loud. You're hearing those locator tones a long ways from that corner. And when you hold the button down so that you hear the intersection location message and you're standing right there by it, that's a very loud message. There's also a problem that has nothing to do with the technology. It has to do with the design of the intersection itself, is that you have two push buttons on the same pole. And that is the main reason for confusion with accessible pedestrian signals in general, whether they have speech messages or any other kind of a message. You can put wonderful technology installed poorly, and it's not going to be very perfect. So you all know, at any rate, what an accessible pedestrian signal that has speech messages can do. There are now five manufacturers that have APSs that can produce speech messages. Polar is probably the one that is most familiar to you, but others are Novax, who's also exhibiting here. That Novax equipment can have speech messages. Prisma, which is manufactured in Sweden and available here, can have speech messages. Panitch, which is manufactured in Australia and distributed here, can have speech messages. And there's a new one on the scene manufactured by a company called Dick Campbell that can also have speech messages. So just because we have come to associate speech messages with Polara, don't think that other kinds can't have them. So if you are in a situation that you're evaluating different kinds of technology for use in your area, for instance, don't think because one manufacturer comes with a speech signal and you like a speech signal that that's the only manufacturer you can use. Maybe you can get a speech signal from the other if you like that better. Well, anyhow, you probably know that there are two different kinds of speech messages that you can get from accessible signals. One is a message that tells you when the walk interval prevails, when the print walk sign is on. The other kind is a message that gives you more information about that intersection when you press the push button. And you won't get that information if the walk signal's on. You'll only get it during the don't walk times, either the flashing don't walk or the steady don't walk. And I'll be talking about that as the push button message. We did research last summer that you participated in on both of those kinds of messages. Because there wasn't any standard for the messaging, and more messages were coming up across the country that were possibly confusing and ambiguous, we felt there needed to be some standardization. But you can't recommend a standard without having some data to support that. And so, with the support and participation of ACB, we conducted that research with your great participation last summer. The research was based on input from stakeholders, including most particularly blind pedestrians, but also orientation and mobility specialists, traffic engineers, and manufacturers. The kinds of information that we got involved in making these recommendations, first of all, came from a survey that you all participated in. That survey was developed by, and later the results interpreted by, an expert panel that was comprised of members of all of these groups that I mentioned. The people representing ACB were Julie Carroll and Pat Beattie. 170 of you participated in that survey last summer. I'll tell you a little bit about the results. I'm not going to go over them in detail. Penny Reeder summarized them very nicely in, I think it was the March issue of the forum, so that if you want this information in detail, that's where you should go look for it. But first of all, in terms of the walk message, the message that comes on when the crosswalk that you want to cross has the walk sign. In the survey, you are presented with a number of options. The one that in general was liked best had the name of the street first. It also was in a full sentences. We gave you options in which things were more phrase-like and ones that were in fuller sentences. Part of the survey also was to find out which messages were best understood. And while many people told us that they liked the shorter messages better, the survey really came out telling us that people liked messages in full sentences better, and there was no question that messages in full sentences were understood the best. And so the result of that is that we come up with a model message, that is one that messages during the walk interval should be patterned after, that says, for instance, Bryan Park, walk sign is on to cross Bryan Park. So the first thing you hear is the name of the street. And then you hear walk sign is on to cross Bryan Park. And it may repeat a couple of times or more for the length of the walk interval. The message that you hear out in the corner is simply, walk sign is on to cross Bryan Park. That means that if you know perfectly well Bryan Park is what you want to cross and you're facing Bryan Park, because those two push-button messages are coming from the same pole, they're coming from exactly the same place, you can't be sure until you hear the word Bryan Park that you've got the walk message that you want. So you've got to listen while it said, walk sign is on to cross, until you finally get the punchline and know whether it's yours. The results of the research last summer were to put the street name first. So it should say Bryan Park. Walk sign is on to cross Bryan Park. So if you know perfectly well which street you want to cross, you know its name, you know you're facing it, you hear Bryan Park, you know that's your signal, you're the street that has the walk sign. You don't know it's safe to cross. All you know is that what that signal says is that the walk sign is on. Then it's up to you to listen for traffic and figure out if it's safe. For the push button message, the push-button message always gives information that identifies the intersection and the crosswalk that is signaled by that push-button. It may give some other information about the nature of the signals at that intersection, if there's something unusual about it, or the geometry of the intersection if there's something unusual. But first of all, we had a number of questions on the survey about this basic message. How should we communicate information about what the name of this intersection is, and which crosswalk is going to be controlled by this push button, so that you know when you push the button that you push the button you meant to push. The upshot of this was that, again, full sentences were the most preferred, and they were also the best understood. Something that was not, there was no significant difference in terms of the survey, but the decision that was made by the expert panel was that the word wait should be the first thing that you hear when you get the message. So the model message is, wait to cross Bryan Park at Westheimer. The signs out here say, for instance, Bryan Park at Westheimer, please wait. The concern was that you only hear this push-button message when it's not your walk interval. And if the first word you hear is the street name, that could be confused with this first name that you hear when it is your walk interval. So the decision was, and the recommendation is, that the first word that you hear from that push-button message is wait, so that you know it's not your turn to cross. And then it goes on to give the information identifying the intersection and the crosswalk. Well, we asked about a number of special applications as well. For instance, we have some places what traffic engineers refer to as an exclusive pedestrian phase. That means that all traffic stops during the pedestrian interval. However, in many places, Massachusetts being a leading example, and I come from Massachusetts, very often right turn on red is permitted. So I'm not sure how exclusive this is. But to a traffic engineer, he'll call that an exclusive ped phase, even though there can still be turning vehicles and you may never have a quiet time to cross. So that's something it'd be nice to know ahead of time if you're not familiar with that intersection. And so the model push-button message for an intersection like that, that came out of this survey last summer, is, for example, wait to cross center at Beacon. wait for red light for all vehicles, right turn on red permitted. Now that's a long message. But that was the best we could come out with in terms of this survey and the expert panel. Another thing that we looked at was a model message when you had an angled crosswalk. And the recommended message here was none of the ones that we included in the survey. It was one that many of you anecdotally told us should be the message. The recommended message where there's an angled crosswalk starts out like all of the push-button messages identifying the intersection. So first it would say, for instance, wait to cross Howard at Grand. And then the part that's telling you about the angled crosswalk simply is crosswalk angles right. We had talked about a clock analogy or how many degrees. Many, many of you said, although this was not included in the survey, it should simply say it angles one way or the other and leave it up to you to figure out something about the amount of the angle. Another thing that was included in the survey was the situation in which the timing for a very wide street only permits you to go as far as a median that has another push button on it, and you have to wait for another cycle to get all the way across the street. The model message in that case, for instance, would be wait to cross Peachtree at Church. Short walk phase. Cut through median with second push button. Letting you know that it's really important to find that median and push another button, or you're not going to have time to get across. Well, there were some other special situations there, too, that I won't go on through. If you want the whole results, go and look at that article in the forum. Penny did a wonderful job with that. Another thing. A last question on that survey had to do with whether you should have to hold the button in for a short time before you got that push button message, or whether it should come on as soon as you hit the button. Results on that were exactly divided. Let me tell you that there will be research going on, it's being conducted by Novax, to determine how long one would need to hold that push button down if we do have a push button delay. Typically now it's about 3 seconds, which can seem like a really long time if you're holding that button. It only needs to be just a fraction of a second longer than most people normally hold the button. It doesn't need to be very long. What we don't know is how long people usually hold the button. Novax has agreed to find that out for us so that we could probably shorten that time considerably. Let me just conclude with mentioning some problems with speech message accessible signals in general, because there are some very important problems to consider. When you're sitting on a committee maybe trying to determine the best kind of accessible signal for a particular intersection or a particular city, you're usually sitting in a room, and you may have distributors bringing in a number of kinds of signals for you to listen to and think about. That's a very poor environment for making a decision about something you're going to have to use in very noisy traffic situations where you're under a lot of pressure because you know that the decision that you make can lead you into a life-threatening situation if you make the wrong decision. When you're sitting in a quiet room and your native English speaker and a sign talks to you, it seems wonderful. There are a lot of problems with it on the street. We know that it is not possible to make speech messages intelligible in all conditions. The louder you make them, the more distorted they get. The louder you make them, the more you approach that range where you can get hearing damage if you are too close to the source of that message. And you may have noticed that for the push button message, if you stand there and hold your finger on the push button out here at Westheimer and Bryant Park, those are really quite loud, those push button messages, when you're standing right by them. Now, a problem we often have in this country is that the push buttons, as you very well know, are often not very close to the crosswalk. And you need to be able to understand the crosswalk message when you're at the curb waiting to cross, not backed by the push button message. So it's got to be loud enough for you to understand it when you're there, which means that it's very loud when you're at the push button. Catch 22. Another catch 22 is that a majority of people with visual impairment are also old enough to have some age-related upper frequency hearing loss. So that means if the message is in a high-pitched voice, woman's voice or higher voice, many people will not be able to understand it. If it is in a male voice or lower pitched voice, in general, people won't understand it as well because traffic sound is mostly in the lower frequencies. Catch 22. We don't have an optimal range to make it. Another problem is that many people will miss or misunderstand words or parts of words. For instance, if you're intersecting streets, are Parker and Palmer, and you're waiting for the walk sign to come on, which is inherently sort of the most pressure kind of time when you're listening to that accessible signal. And maybe it's back a ways from you. It's not right by you. So you're not hearing it really loud. And the message comes on. Paca, walk sign is on to cross Paca. Is that Parker or is it Palmer? Well, it depends a little on what part of the country you come from and how you're used to hearing it. Whether you understand it or not depends a little bit on whether you're a native English speaker. So at any rate, you're going to have many people who will often not understand the full message. The best way to make messages unambiguous is to have accessible signals come from two separate locations on the corner. The accessible signal for each crosswalk needs to be near the street, not way far away from the street. It needs to be at the side of the crosswalk that is farthest from the intersection. And that means that the two push buttons on the same corner are going to be separated by a distance of 10 feet or more. And then it doesn't much matter what that message says or what tone it may have or anything else about it. It's yours if it's the one where you're standing. It's yours if it's the one you just pushed. And you can tell. You don't have to remember, is it a cuckoo or a chirp, or listen to the language about it, or know the name of the street. As long as you know which street you want to cross and you're standing there waiting for it, it's the message, it's the tone, it's the whatever that's coming from that push button that's right in the right place. The draft guidelines from the Access Board, as well as language in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, now have recommendations that push buttons on the same corner always be separated by a minimum of 10 feet. And I think that's something that ACB needs to take very seriously in your advocacy. There are also allies who are traffic engineers who say that that's the best place for all push buttons. So I encourage you to make this a big push in your advocacy efforts. God bless you all.
Thank you very much. As announced earlier, we will allow three questions.
This is Pat Beattie. Yes. I'd like to thank you, BZ, for all of the work that you do as chair of AER's committee, but that you don't speak for us, you partner with us, you ask us, and you listen. Thank you so much.
Ms. Chair.
Thank you, Pat.
Ms. Chairman. Ron Hepler from Virginia Association of the Blind. I'm one of those engineers you refer to. I'm a sighted volunteer for the Virginia Association of the Blind. One of the big things that we're looking at as an independent municipality is the cost to retrofit an existing signal and the cost of putting it in a new design of a signal. We haven't been able to really get a grip on that cost. There are a lot of manufacturers out there
We've looked at the access board's recommendations. We have a very big handicap ramp program, retrofitting handicap ramps throughout the city. But the cost is what we're worried about as a municipality. Do you have any kind of estimates as far as retrofitting existing signals and putting in as part of a new signal?
I don't.
We don't either.
Yeah, costs of all of the good technologies are fairly similar. Some of the cost, big cost difference is in how your corner infrastructure is. Because we know that the best way to provide intersection is to get the accessible signals on two different poles. And very often you'll have a single signal pole, and it may be in a very poor location.
That we've looked at that, and what we've talked about doing is putting in a four-foot pole next to the handicap ramp on each ramp that there's an intersection.
That is absolutely the best solution.
And that individual pole will have a white strobe light on the top as a little extra indicator to try to, you know, for those people who have low vision. But there again, single poles are the best cost for a municipality rather than multiple poles. And right now it costs the city of Chesapeake, where I'm an engineer, about $140,000 per intersection to put a traffic signal up. So when you talk about adding these extra features, we have to have a real good handle on how much money it's going to cost. And right now, we have not. We've tried some experimental signals, and it hasn't worked very well because of the traffic noise. So we're in the dark.
Yeah, the real cost, if you're going to do it well, is to do it like you're doing it. But there's no way for us to come up, or anybody else to come up with a kind of a specific answer, because, as you know, what you've got to deal with on every corner in order to get those two poles in varies.
Well, we're looking at this as far as installing it. All our systems are computerized. We have a master traffic center, and we're looking at a computerized system, putting it right into our box, our traffic control signal box, but still we've been unable to get a handle on the cost. And manufacturers, it's like if this, if that, you know, that type of thing. Well, it's a brand new signal. You just tell us what you need and we'll do it. But like I say, the cost is a big problem right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm Dolores Coombs from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I'm wondering why the white lines cannot be moved back to where the buttons are. To me, it seems like that would be a lot less expensive. It would be safer because we'd be further away from the cars that are turning into our traffic pattern instead of trying to make the talking signs do all the work.
I think a problem with just moving the white lines is in the great many variations in locations of the push buttons. In some cases, you may have just one on a corner, a great many cases. And moving the crosswalk lines really isn't going to help you.
Madam, Leo Healy from Georgia, possible?
I'm sorry, we only are allowing three questions.
Madam, my name is Jim Norman.
No, I'm sorry, we have to move on.
I thought that was only the second question. That was only the second question, wasn't it?
We're going to move on to our next speaker. First of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Beasy Benson for speaking to us this morning.
Oh, jeez. Go ahead and just announce them, and they'll come up.
Okay, our next speaker on the agenda, we have the sound alert locator system. These people were here for the mid-year meeting and had locators throughout the hotel. Everyone enjoyed hearing them and picking up the sounds. They were extremely interesting. Today we have Professor Deborah Willington, and she is a neuroscientist from Leeds University in the United Kingdom, and also John Fenna
from the United Kingdom. John was here in February to visit with us and tell us about his alert locator system. Are they in the room? Thank you. Thank you. And now we have our speaker.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great honor to be invited to speak with you today, and I hope that I'm going to be sharing with you the research that we've been doing in the UK over the last 8 years on how to get out of a building safely. Because the worst case situation is the fire alarm sounds. You respond eventually, you get up off your seat, and the real question is, where are the exits? Now, you know, I'm sighted. I can tell you they're beautiful, lovely exit signs all over the walls, but they are of no use to anybody who is blind or partially sighted. And furthermore, they're of no use to anybody who's sighted in the worst case situation, which is when there's actually a fire and this place fills full of smoke. So, hey, we're all in the same boat. We need to find our way out. And what I hope that I will describe to you today is something that will help everybody, whether they're blind, partially sighted, or sighted and in a fire. The idea is we need to get out of the building, the aeroplane, the ship, as fast as we possibly can. Now, people have talked for many years about making audible exits. Now, in my introduction, they called me a neuroscientist. It's a lovely title. It means I study the brain for my sins. I've always wanted to be called a brain surgeon, but I'm not. All I know about is sound and the brain. And the most important thing I know about is what sort of sound that our brains instantly respond to. And this is a survival thing. All animals, humans included, can respond to sound and pinpoint it really accurately to within 3 or 4 degrees, which is absolutely ample to find, you know, an exit. But it has to be a certain type of sound. Now, you'll all hear sounds all the time, and there'll be some, the lovely mobile phones that ring, that you think, where on earth is that sound? And the reason for that is, it's the wrong type of sound. Now, just go back in time, go back in evolution. Imagine primitive man. He's out on the plains, the club's over his shoulder. There's a crack of a twig. If he has to wait to see what is making that noise, he's just been eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. He has to know instantly where that sound is coming from, because it could be a real nasty predator. And what did I say about mobile phones? I must have queued one in. There's always one. So, a crack of a twig, really good sound. Rustling leaves, very good sound. You can instantly pinpoint that. Running water. These are all sounds that are essential for survival. And we can do it really well given those type of sounds. But if we analyse them, what sort of sounds are they? Well, it's described as a broadband sound, multiple frequency. Now, I don't mean to bore you, but just bear with me for a little bit where I tell you a little bit about sound and the human brain. We hear, when we're 20 years old, so I'm glad you can't see, I'm just a little bit past that, but we hear from 20 hertz up to 20,000 hertz, a fantastic range of frequencies. And okay, that higher end drops as we get older, but nevertheless, we can hear a huge range of frequencies. Now, to pinpoint a sound, there are 3 pieces of information our brain must have. It must have some of the low frequency sounds, sounds below 1,000 hertz. It must have sounds above 3,000 hertz and sounds above 5,000 hertz. If the sound contains all those frequencies, then we call it a broadband sound, and we can pinpoint it really accurately. Now, the human voice is not within that sound range, within the range we would call broadband. So if you have someone calling to you over a parking lot, I'm over here, it's really difficult to actually find them because the human voice is not really designed to be pinpointed. So we have the most fantastic computer. It's called our brain. And we can't change that. We've got it. What we can change is the type of sounds that we present to our brain. And if we give them the right type of sound, which, as I said, is broadband sound, then our brain instantly can tell where that sound is coming from. And that's what I call directional sound. And I have a dream that I would like all buildings one day to have these sounds wherever the exits are, that enable anybody to actually evacuate or leave that building in an emergency and to be able to use these sounds. And a little bit of my dream has been realised in the UK and on the continent. There are buildings now that you can go to that these sounds are in place. There's a resource centre for the visually impaired that has these sounds in. There are residential homes that have these sounds to help the inhabitants evacuate the building. One of them was a two-storey building which has 50 or so blind or partially sighted residents. And before these sounds were, the localizer sounds were put over the exit, the strategy in that building was all the residents were told when they heard the fire alarm, wait inside your room until somebody sighted comes to guide you. We then asked how many people there were to help at night. Hey, there was one warden. He was she was going to be seriously busy. Christ, you want to get out yourself. You do not need to wait for somebody sighted to guide you to safety. Now, we've done, as I said, research over 8 years on this. We've done it in buildings, on ships, in aircraft. And in every single situation, we have shown that we can cut evacuation times by up to 75%. That is the difference between life and death. And what you're all thinking about is, well, okay, what's this broadband sound like? Well, it's not something you'd be used to because it's pretty different. And what I'm going to do is play you a sound now that enables you to see or hear what I'm talking about. Okay. I heard some people saying, it's at the back of you. You're all right. It is at the back of you. I'm going to ask for a audio tape to be played now, which is of some research that was done and shown on television. And you're thinking, why am I showing you something, you know, something that was shown on television? Well, the reason is I'll set up, you know, the scene so you can imagine it. It was done on board a ship. We had all these volunteers. We stuffed them into cabins, and then we filled the place full of smoke. I was in one of those cabins. It was getting hot and uncomfortable. And then they were asked to evacuate the ship. When the first lot that evacuated just had to find their way out using conventional low location marking that's on ships. And the narrator is a Professor Ed Galea, so that as they come into the audio clip, it says, and Ed says... Well, this is Professor Galea from the School of Fire Safety Engineering in London, UK. And what it does is describe the trials to you, because first of all, there's the poor guys that had to get out without any help. And then secondly, there's the group that had to get out with a little bit of help. And I'd like you to listen to the difference. Oh, it starts with a fire alarm. Do not get up.
To evaluate how this problem could be solved, Ed has set up an experiment. First, 10 volunteers are put into a smoke-filled ship and told to find their way out, aided only by conventional alarms.
Visibility is very poor in here. You cannot see, I'd say, not even half a meter. Some people have no idea where they are. The person stuck in the middle of the corridor, he's turned around and he's moving towards the far end of the corridor.
It takes the volunteers over 2 minutes to completely exit the smoke-filled deck. But many initially ended up in dead ends. If the smoke had been real, half of them would have died. The sound alert system can be programmed by the ship's captain to direct passengers, or in this case, a second group of volunteers, to only the safe exits.
Second lot of people have gone immediately in the right direction, all heading towards the right area.
The system uses quick bursts of noise containing all the frequencies audible to the human ear, allowing the escaping passengers to accurately pinpoint the alarms. Even in zero visibility, they just have to keep walking toward the source of the sound, following each successive alarm until they reach safety.
They seem to be moving quite quickly along the corridor, heading in the right direction.
And by using swooping frequencies, the system can even tell them whether they need to go down or up staircases. In this second test, a different group of volunteers take less than half the time to find their way out of the smoke-logged corridors. And in a ship fire, every second counts. This prototype system is now being evaluated by companies around the world. Improvements such as this will be vital in minimizing the death and devastation of future fires at sea, because cruise ships are getting bigger. The Yarmouth Castle had 552 on board. Almost a fifth died. Now, cruise ships can carry up to 10 times as many people. The potential for disaster is growing.
That just gives a taste of some of the research that we've been doing. We've done now research with thousands of people, and we never stop anybody coming on our trials, whether they have any hearing impairment or visual impairment. We welcome everybody onto the trials because it's important that this works for everybody. Because people have said to me, well, hey, it's obvious it'll work for anybody with a visual impairment. We also know that all people with hearing impairment, it seems to work for as well. And that's predominantly because it's got this huge range of frequencies. So, as I said, this is my dream, that a simple system like this that doesn't rely on any language, so it doesn't matter whether you're Russian, Japanese, American, English, whatever, you can understand the system. And one of the big questions that we're asked is, well, do you have to explain to people what the sound means? Well, we have done the research on that, with people that were told about the sound and then people that weren't told about the sound. And, hey, it didn't make any difference. In a real evacuation, you are desperate. You really need to find something that is going to take you to safety. And certainly the work that we've done thus far shows that this is a possibility. And I'm not saying it's the answer to everything. We'll still have the fire alarm. That will still be there to tell you to get up off your seats. There'll still be the lighted exit signs. But this should be there as well to provide all the sensory systems with the information they need for evacuation. I hope you found this presentation interesting. There are handouts in Braille, large print, and audio cassettes of the presentation at the front that we would be happy to give you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
I'd like to ask the professor, have you conducted research in
One of the problems I see is that conventional fire alarm systems that we're all used to are extremely loud. One of the problems I see is, how are you going to be able to hear this sound system over some of the conventional alarm systems? And how are we, and I see a big problem taking all the fire codes and stuff to allow us to even catch this. Have you done research with conventional fire alarm systems that we're used to along with the sound alarm system? And what have been some results of that?
Thank you for the question. Well, as I said, it is not designed to replace any existing system. So the fire alarm would still be there. And we have done all our trials with the fire alarm itself actually playing at the same time. Because you should be well aware, we can attend to lots of different sounds at any one time. I can hear all sorts of gentle voices going on. I can hear somebody moving about on the platform. And I choose which one I attend to. Now, when the fire alarm goes off, that is the most important sound. It is telling you to move. The minute you have made the decision to move, that sound is irrelevant. It doesn't matter anymore. And it can keep going, but you then attend to the other sounds. And all the research we have done has had the fire alarm and the evacuation sound as going at the same time, so they don't conflict with one another.
I have a question. Mary Lou Baraka from Los Angeles. Have you ever thought of working with the airlines?
Yes, and in fact, that's a very good question. We've done lots of research on evacuating aircraft, again, full of smoke, because I love being in these smoky environments. And one of the fascinating things we found was that when we did one full aircraft full of evacuation of an aircraft, we had boarded all the passengers from the rear of the plane to remind them these planes do have rear exit doors. Then we made one exit at the front available, two exits at the back available. Every single passenger except one evacuated through the front of the plane. That was really bad news until the sound alert evacuation beacons were used. And then there was an equal split amongst all the available doors. So we have done the work with the airlines, and we hope that they soon will take this on board.
Mr. David.
Hello, Professor. Hello. Jim Eccles, Washington State. The question I'd like to ask you is, if you're slightly over 20, were you there for Live at Leeds, and was the concert as good as the album? But the question I'm gonna, but the question I'm going to ask you is, what kind of expense are we talking about if I run home and tell my city council or my airline on the way home that they ought to run out and get these? What are we talking about in terms of money for installations in ships, planes, etc.?
We're not talking huge amounts of money. I mean, at the moment, because we are talking with American manufacturers about getting this sort of built and available in the US, there isn't a sort of specific amount, but we know that we will try and keep it as low as possible, and the technology isn't very complicated that's involved in it, so we're hoping that it should be sort of well under $100 for any locator system, and I say well under.
Question. David Ellen,
Association of the Blind. And I'm like to ask this question. Y'all could see that you gave a demonstration of how this system works and everything.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
We have several people wanting to speak, and I believe we've already had our three questions.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry, folks. But if we don't end this, then we're going to, be here through lunch. Dr. Withington, Professor, I'm sorry, will you be here?
Yes.
So that people can ask you questions later?
Yeah. And that room 1068, whatever it was.
Oh, tonight, in 1068, she will be there. If any of you want to ask questions. Thank you.
You just remember all the handouts at the front with all the contact details.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Jennifer Simpson is here. from the Federal Communications Commission, and she wants to talk to us today about talking TVs. I've never had mine talk back yet, but maybe it will. And talking telephones. Ms. Simpson.
Hi, I am Jennifer Simpson from the Federal Communications Commission from Washington, D.C. And I'm very happy to be here and be your guest and speaker. It's written up as talking phones and TVs, but what I want to tell you about a little bit more is sort of go behind that to the federal rules and regulations that address these. When they asked me to speak on this, they had said, give an update on Section 255 and on the video description rules. So that is what I prepared for you. I also want to say that the American Council for the Blind is very highly regarded at the Federal Communications Commission. When anyone of the commissioners wants to know how the community of people with severe vision and blindness is thinking about something, they will say to the specialists like myself, who do we talk to out there? And we obviously say the American Council for the Blind and some other organizations. So your Washington office does an excellent job of giving feedback. I'm going to talk first about the talking phone part. That's Section 255 of the rules. And that's the rules under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. I'm going to give a summary of the rule, and then I'm going to talk about the complaints and compliance issues and some of the concerns we're seeing, and I know some of the concerns you have. I'm going to do that same format on when I talk about video description. I'm going to give a summary, and I'm going to give you an update on the challenge and the compliance and complaint issues. I think most of you are familiar with Section 255 of the Communications Act. It requires the manufacturers of telecommunications equipment, that's the guys who make the phones, and the providers of telecommunications services, that's the guys who sell you services, to make their products and services accessible to people with disabilities. They're supposed to be looking at the consideration of disability access in the design, the development, and the fabrication stages. If they can't do it, they're supposed to make it accessible to your equipment that you use. Section 255 applies only to products designed, developed, and fabricated after the law took effect on February 8, 1996. So if you've got old phones out there, you can't complain, we can't do anything about it. It also applies only to the extent that accessibility measures are readily achievevable. And that's a concept, that's a legal concept that means both technologically feasible and there are some economic considerations, obviously, that go into that. The kind of products we're talking about cover all telephone network equipment, including software that's in the network. It means they can't put a barrier in the network. That means you can't have access. And all telecommunications equipment that is used in the home or office or any other premises that are used to originate, route, or terminate telecommunications. So it can't be just a one-way. It's the whole closing of the call or the message or whatever. Examples of the equipment are telephones, fax machines, answering machines, and pagers. Also, equipment that provides both telecommunications and non-telecommunications functions, that would be like an information service, for instance, is covered only to the extent that it provides telecommunications functions. So if you're talking about some of these new converging little devices, the part that's telecom service would be covered under 255, but other pieces might not. The services we're talking about cover basic phone services, dial tone calling, things like that, including call waiting, speed dialing, call forwarding, computer-provided directory assistance, call monitoring, caller identification, call tracing, and repeat dialing. Additionally, the rules also cover interactive voice response, referred to as IVR systems, and voicemail. IVR systems are phone systems that provide callers with menus of choices. We have a separate set of rules that address those. They look a lot like the rules for access to equipment and services, and we do get some complaints related to those. One of the critical things that the Section 255 regulations require is that the manufacturers and the service providers have to have a point of contact at their company. I believe some of you already met the person who was here from AT&T Wireless the other day and the person from Singular and I think someone from Motorola. And those are the key people at those companies, because when we at the FCC serve complaints, those are the ones we serve them on, and it has to go to an individual so it doesn't get lost within the company. And we also maintain a list of those for you and for all issues that get raised, so you can contact them or we can contact them and find out who they are. And this was a very important part of the rules, by the way. Another part in terms of enforcement is that there is no standing requirement to file such a complaint. It means that anyone can file a complaint. A person with a disability, the family member, the friend, the employer, an organization, and even a telephone company if they wanted to. They could file a complaint against another company. However, the key to remember, there is no private right of action under Section 255. This means that if you want to file such a complaint, you have to do it with the FCC. There is no redress in the courts. So the adjudication of the complaint is solely with the FCC. Now, informal complaints may be submitted to the Federal Communications Commission by letter, fax, call-in by TTY, through email, through an audio cassette recording, or in Braille. You can send it any way you like to us. And that's in the rules. There's no time limit for filing complaints, but consumers should try to file shortly after they discover the access problem. And we strongly encourage consumers who file a complaint to do so under the informal complaint process. There's no fee for this, and we need quite a bit of information. And the critical information we need is the name and address of the person making the complaint. We actually get quite a few complaints where we don't find that out. We need a telephone number or a way to contact you during the day in case we need clarification. We also need the name of the manufacturer or service provider. You know, we get a lot of complaints coming in that say cell phones don't work because, yes, we know that, and that is a complaint from maybe your perspective, but it's not a complaint from the FCC's perspective unless you name the manufacturer. Whose device is it? Whose service is being sold to you? We need to know the date the equipment or the service was purchased, acquired, or used. The date you attempted to purchase, acquire, or use the item. So you don't actually have to have bought the service in order to file the complaint. You just have to be very particular and tell us what you tried to do and what the access barrier was. And we need a statement of facts from you that support the inaccessibility that you're naming. And the more specific you can be about that, the better. We also would like you to tell us the relief you want, like, you know, propose the solution that you think would work. And we also need to know from you your preferred method of response from the company. Do you want them to write back by letter, fax, TTY, Braille, etc.? And when we serve the notice on the company in the informal complaint process, we tell them that they have to reply within 30 days to us, the FCC, and send you a copy or whatever. And we tell them to do it in the format you tell us. So we have made, obviously some companies have had to send Braille out for the first time in terms of the responses here. It works. The formal complaint process is a little different. There is a fee involved. And you must certify that a good faith effort has been made to work out the problem with the company. This is why we encourage you to do the informal complaint process first, but it's not a requirement. And we also ask you to submit very detailed information in support of your position. In other words, you have to have quite a bit of substance to your argument in terms of how you've tried to resolve this or why you believe they are at fault. There is a filing fee. I think it's $165. But the FCC may waive this fee if they believe it's in the public interest to do so. In terms of penalties, the FCC has considerable authority to impose a lot of penalties against the companies that fail to comply with 255, monetary damages against companies that furnish the services to the general public. We can do license revocations, we can do cease and desist orders, and we can do retrofitting requirements. A company that's required to retrofit a product would be required to go back and make its product accessible to people with disabilities. In order for such a situation to occur, there would have to be an egregious patent that was shown to the FCC. In other words, a huge number of complaints essentially about the same thing. Let me just tell you a little bit about how the complaints are going under Section 255 at the FCC. I'm going to give you the report based on the numbers since March 2002. There was a reform at the agency, and all the complaints and inquiries that were previously handled by the Disability Rights Office in a separate process have now been or are being integrated into the main complaint process at the FCC in a division called the Consumer Inquiries and Complaints Division, and that's where I'm assigned to work. And that division receives over 10,700 complaints and inquiries a month. Now, of that lot, in that three-month period, March, April, May, June, four-month period, only 305 of that 10,000 complaints were disability-related. And of that 305, about 54% were telephony related. That means they were either Section 255 or they were relay services. By and large, we got an incredible number of relay services out of the disability complaints. 15% television related, that's closed captioning and some video description. The rest were 25% about general information, or the rest basically end up being non-FCC. We get a lot of inquiries that people think we have regs for, but we don't enforce. And now, of that 305 complaints, of the 10,000, only 90 involved Section 255 concerns. That's in a four-month period. The majority of that, two-thirds, were inquiries about the rules, about who's a covered entity, what's a product involved, who's the point of contact, some kind of clarification needed. And a lot of those are companies wanting clarification as well as consumers. The smallest number, then, about 30, are actual complaints. I'm going to tell you a little bit about those complaints. The majority are about bills and product information in alternate formats. Our rules say they must make bills accessible to people with disabilities. We don't tell them they must braille it. We don't tell them they must put it in a certain format. We just tell them they must make it accessible. The rest of the complaints involved accessible wireline and wireless phone devices. Devices like cell phones, not being able to read them, not being able to understand the text messaging on the device, things like that. Or button issues or TTY compatibility issues. We also get complaints on the directory operator assistance issue. And a growing concern, by the way, is access to customer service support centers. Rude people at the customer service centers who are insensitive to disability issues. We also get high complaints involving product manuals not being able to be gotten in an accessible format. I just sort of want to make a sort of statement that the majority, though, are equipment-related complaints. Can't see the screen, can't navigate through it. They're about hearing aid compatibility with phone devices. They're about TTY compatibility. The others, which are service-related, are the alternative billing issues, bad customer service, the product in alternate format, and billing plan confusions. That's another one. Pending service right now, which means they're under review. When something gets sent to us, we review it, and it's quite a review process that goes on. It's like 15 complaints are currently under review for potential service. Anyway, I can talk a little bit more about the complaints under 255 a little bit if there's time in the question and answer period. But anyone can make a complaint at any time to the FCC. You can send it by email, fccinfo@fcc.gov, and just say it's a Section 255. If you believe it is, you don't have to. I'm going to move quickly now to the other part, which is video description. I'm going to give a summary of the rules because it's a new rule. I mean, I think all of you here know what video description is, and we have a legal definition of it, and you know that it's provided on the second audio program channel on your TV, and we know that most television sets manufactured since 1990 have a SAP channel. You should note that the FCC rules do not require a SAP channel on televisions, and you should know that the rules went into effect April the 1st, 2002. The people who are required to provide video description fall into three categories. They are broadcast stations, that is the affiliates of ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC networks, who are in the top 25 TV markets. And that was the top 25 TV markets as of September the 30th, 2000. So if you were number 25 that date, and you've now slipped to 26, you're still required to do it, and that is the case. So it's not who's the top 25 now is of that date. The second group of people required to provide video description are what we call, and this is an FCC jargon, multi-channel video programming providers. This basically means cable and satellite providers. These are distributors of television services that have 50,000 or more subscribers, and they must provide video descriptions on their top five networks. These are the top five non-broadcast networks. And you're probably familiar with these. These are Lifetime, Nickelodeon, Turner Broadcasting or TBS, Turner Network Television, and the USA Network. The only non-cable distributors with more than 50,000 subscribers are the two well-known satellite companies that you're probably familiar with, DirecTV and EchoStar, which I believe is sold as Dish TV. You should know that some multi-channel video programming providers, that's your cable and your satellite folks, that carry the program of local broadcast stations currently may not carry the SAP channel for the programming in their stations because of the manner in which the station provides the programming to the cable or satellite company. There's some technological issues with that link. When this happens, viewers should alert the local broadcast station and your distributor who you pay money to and try and get some resolution and also tell us about that. And you can also try and pick up the video description, therefore, over an antenna if you also have that. The third group that is required to provide video description under our rules is any broadcast TV station, regardless of the TV market in which it's located, with several conditions. If its programming provider supplies a soundtrack with video description, in other words, they've got it, they've got to pass it through. The broadcast TV station has the technical capability to support that. In other words, they've got to have the machinery at the station and at the cable head end in order to do that. And it does not provide another program-related use on the secondary audio program channel. So if the Spanish coming through on the show that's a regularly translated program use, you're not going to get the English video description because that is how it works. Any distributor, regardless of the number of its subscribers, must provide a soundtrack with video description when its provider supplies the soundtrack, has the technical capability to do so, and it doesn't provide another SAP. That's what that really says. We don't require any other entities to provide video description, although we do know that the Public Broadcasting Service, PBS, and Turner Classic Movies provide some programming with video description. We also know that most local PBS stations support a SAP channel. You must remember this critical issue. The distributors must associate specialized equipment to support the SAP with each channel on which they wish to provide the SAP. For example, if a cable system provides Spanish on HBO via SAP, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the technical capability to provide video description for what's on TNT. They have to associate each channel separately. Now, the rules say that they must provide 50 hours of video description per calendar quarter. That's about 16 hours or so a month, or about 4 hours a week. And that's during children's programming or during prime time. In other words, they can't meet the commitment at 2 a.m. in the morning. Broadcast TV stations and the distributors, that's the cable and the satellite folks, may count programs twice per channel toward the 50-hour requirement. For example, when the Fox network airs Boston Public with video description, its affiliated stations may count the program toward their 50-hour requirements the first and the second time Fox airs the program. As you know, there's sometimes a lag between an episode being shown broadcast and then being shown on cable. So they've got it twice, they can count it twice. Am I running over time? Okay. I wanted to give you a little update on the court case. I'm sure you've heard that there's a challenge to our rules. Basically, the matter is currently out of the hands of the FCC, and there isn't likely to be anything that we do until the court rules on the matter. However, at the FCC, we've upheld our rules. Petitions for I'll just recount the story. The petitions for reconsideration after the rule went out were filed with the FCC, in which we denied. The plaintiffs then filed with the District of Columbia Court for a stay of the rules. because they said there was still a court decision pending. We also denied that request. Basically, we've upheld the rules three times since the rules came out. We understand that a hearing is scheduled September 9 for oral arguments around this. And while there's no hard and fast rule on when courts decide a matter, they usually do so within several months of the argument period. So it, although we can't guess there, we think that maybe there could be a decision by December or January, but there's no guarantee on that. As you know, the first quarter for compliance ended this past Sunday, June the 30th. It's 50 hours per calendar quarter, so it's April, May, June, and then the next quarter starts, so 50 hours per three-month segment. The Consumer and Governmental Affairs Bureau, which I work for, handles the informal complaints. The Enforcement Bureau handles formal complaints, and the Media Bureau handles waivers. So whatever comes to the FCC gets sorted and sent to different bureaus within the agency, depending on what it's about. Again, with complaints, we need lots of details. It's very similar to Section 255 and all the disability complaint processes. Full name and address, and so we can contact you to clarify a phone number during the day, your work number, whatever. We need you to cite which program, the dates and the times, and how you viewed it. We need you to tell us if it was over the air antenna, if it was cable or satellite service that you're paying for. We'd like to know the address of the cable and satellite provider, too, because that's who we serve the complaint on. We don't serve it on the A&E channel. We serve it on the distributor of the video programming. Any details you can tell us would be helpful. Let me give you a little summary of what we've seen in terms of the access to television complaints this year. As I said before, there are about 14 to 15% of all the disability-related complaints, of that 305 of the 10,000 that the Bureau gets each quarter. The access to TV complaints are around access to emergency information. We hear a lot from the deaf and hard of hearing community about lack of pass-through of captioning, blocking of captioning, things like that. We're starting to see complaints about lack of pass-through of video description. And obviously, since it's now we're in the July piece, we can now start serving complaints that were from the first quarter of the rules that allege lack of pass-through of video description. I think that's all I really had to say on this. Anyway, I can have a, take a couple of questions.
Mr. Chairman, this is Michael Byington. I direct, among other things, the Telecommunications Equipment Distribution Program in Kansas, and my question is this. If the 255 equipment that's finally beginning to start trickling down is going to have accessibility features in it, but if 255 is enforceable at only the readily achievable level, which is the case, how much additional cost do you anticipate is going to be considered justifiable to pass on to the consumer for the adaptive equipment necessary to achieve compatibility under 255? And obviously, in looking at the future of my program, how much of that cost do you feel equipment distribution programs around the country should be looking at in terms of the guarantee of full access?
You raise a very interesting issue, I think, around the cost issues. We don't tell the companies, you know, how much to charge for anything. There is also no requirement, as you know, for equipment distribution. That's a voluntary program that the states participate in.
Yes.
So there's obviously, you know, two separate policy issues going on here. I think the question around readily achievable has never been resolved in terms of what the statutory language says in terms of the four factors around what a company could afford to do. And I think it will be through the complaint process, probably through some formal complaints, that this might be defined. There have only been two formal complaints filed under Section 255 at the FCC, as far as I know. One was dismissed 2 years ago, and I believe there's one under review right now. And I believe, although I'm not sure, that it probably does look at that issue. But basically, what the FCC does in terms of any orders, rulings, whatever, responses, it is based, it's complaint-driven, or it's based on petitions that are made to the FCC in order to clarify what its rules mean. So it's very hard to answer your questions of without very specific allegations being made, say, about a particular product, device, service, you know, how they responded in terms to a number of consumers with those issues. It's a process that needs to occur, I believe, that what you're naming.
Thank you. And my compliments on the accessibility of the FCC website. I have to use it a lot in my job, and it's really seen some nice changes there.
Ms. Simpson, my name is Jan Hawthorne from Jackson, Mississippi. I have a digital cable box, and I want to know if those are covered under the Section 255 because they don't seem to pass through the audio description that is available without the cable box.
No.
Thank you.
But write and tell us about it anyway. Would you do that? It would be very helpful for us to know what functions and features are in that digital cable box, who the manufacturer is, what you would like it to do. In the office I work in, we keep an electronic set of comments that people tell us about equipment and services, and they are passed along for review to attorneys that develop regulations and that develop policy. So just because right now, from what you told me, it doesn't sound like it fits, at some point maybe there'll be a service, like a telecommunications service, that you would be paying for directly through that would be covered. Remember, if it has a telecommunications service function in it, it may be covered. So write up and tell us this and send it in, and you can send it to fccinfo@fcc.gov. Put your name, address on it, and I'll circulate it, make sure the attorneys look at it, and we'll sort of get a little bit more handle on it. We'll also know that you are interested in it. The Consumer Governmental Affairs Bureau wants to know what consumers are interested in terms of products and services, what they're buying, what they're seeing, anything. And we can make use of whatever you tell us is going on. And how much you pay for things. We need to know details all the time. Thanks.
Madam Presenter, Jim Eccles, Washington State. If there's in the coming case, in the hell.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're running behind time, and Jennifer has a flight to catch. If you have any questions or comments, please contact her at fcc.gov. Also, Jennifer, would you please take back to the FCC our gratitude for upholding the rulings? We at ACB appreciate that. And thank you so much for coming. We are going to take a quick break, but before we do, I have an announcement to make. After the break, our programming is going to be changed. We will be having a young lady talk to us about election reform, and then we're going to hear from our narrator, and that's always a highlight of our convention. Now I would like to turn the microphone over to our president for a couple announcements.
Door prizes.
Doc Bradley, if you could be on tap in 10 minutes to start door prizes to help get people back in the room. Ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention just one more moment. We're not in recess yet. They have a chance of participating in this. I would like you all to know that our own Pat Beatty and Michael Garrett are going to do a live interview about the ACB on Channel 8, TV Channel 8 at 12:30 this afternoon, and wish them well. Okay. I also want to remind you about the tickets for the dinner tonight, the Zha Yang dinner tonight, over in the Hilton. There's quite a few left, and we need to sell those tickets. Go get them during the break or at noon. And remember, the registration office closes at 2 p.m. today. Okay? The sound materials are up in the front, and our speaker, who just finished on the FCC, will wait in the front if you want to come up and ask her your questions during the break.
No, she said she'd wait 20 minutes.
She'll be here for the next 15 or 20 minutes only. If you have questions, come and ask her. We are now in recess for about 10 minutes.
President Chris Gray putting the convention into recess for a short period. You're listening to live coverage from the National Convention of the American Council of the Blind being held this year at the Adams Mike Hotel in Houston, Texas. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and if you would like to contact us while we're on the air, you can do so by using email or MSN Instant Messenger. If you have Windows XP, of course, it's called Windows Messenger. And the address for either of those contact methods is convention@acbradio.org. That's convention@acbradio.org. And a programming note for you: today is the last day of the exhibits and we're running concurrent broadcasts now. You can tune over to ACB Radio Interactive and hear the crew who are broadcasting from the exhibits until 1 p.m. when they close. And although I'm going to run out of time and really am not going to be able to give you much coverage from there, I understand some interviews are being done over there, and we'll see if we can grab those for main menu. And also, we are lining up some interviews relating to things that have been seen. There's a lot of interest in the Pac-Mate, which I had a play with yesterday, and there are a few other items of great interest there too, so we'll see what we can get for you. Let's take a look at some of the things that people are doing today. Seeing Eye graduates had a breakfast this morning, 7 o'clock, bright and early. I tell you what, the further we go through these conventions, the longer they take to fill up in the morning. There's also a Women's Concerns Committee breakfast that was on this morning, looking at roles and role models. Good topic. Mentoring's always very important. The RSVA, Randolph Shepherd Vendors of America, had a post-convention board meeting this morning, bright and early at 7. And other things that are happening is the caucuses that go on, because we do have elections, and you'll be able to hear live coverage of those elections on Friday. Positions we'll be voting on include, I believe it's 5 for the Board of Directors and also some for the Board of Publications. On yesterday, Oral Miller presented in his capacity as chairman of the nominating committee the slate that the nominating committee is recommending for the Board of Directors and Board of Publications. But the convention can and does from time to time vote differently. And we'll talk more about the voting procedure for those of you who haven't heard of ACB elections before on Friday morning. So right throughout the week, the various affiliates caucus, they get together and they speak with the candidates, find out what they stand for, what they hope to bring to the positions that they seek, and they come up with a view. Some use the unit rule, which means that all of the votes go to a particular candidate. Others do their best to determine a proportionality of the feelings of the membership and vote accordingly. The Youth Activity Centre is back open again today. And I don't know whether we are on fire or whether there's just smoke in the room, but it's getting pretty bad. Maybe we'll have to try one of those new devices that Deborah Withington was talking about. We did have quite a bit of interest in that device, by the way, and I am going to try and see if we can get Professor Withington on the program. And I promise you, we'll try and not talk about the arches, at least not for the whole program.
Materials from Debbie Withington are...
Okay, I thought they were going to give us some gossip there. Let me see, what have we got there? We have been asked by... I'm just going through my email to see what I should be mentioning. Pat Price dropped us an email. Nice to hear from you, Pat. With respect to the handouts that people are giving away here from time to time to accompany their addresses... I will attempt to find out about those for you and see if we can make them available in some way, but we certainly hope to have some of these guests available on Blindline, because not only are we limited in terms of our ability as an internet audience to ask questions, but also lots of people here have questions that they haven't had a chance to ask. So we will do some follow-up with some of these speakers.
John Fenner, are you in the room?
The exhibits, as I say, are now open. They close at 1 o'clock, and that is the end of the exhibits. It's incredible, you know, it's just so well set up. So much technology and internet access and electricity that's required to get that going, and then it all comes down after 1 o'clock this afternoon. Massive operation, and I was privileged to be witness to the way that was all set up. I got in on Friday, and we did quite a bit of work on some of the ACB radio facilities, and everybody's just so diligent, hauling huge amounts of material into there. Just incredible stuff, and it all comes down today. After we conclude the general session,
ladies and gentlemen, if you are looking
there are
for the sound material,
some other items on. The ACB Lions have a business meeting this afternoon.
And she will have the sound material with her.
As I've mentioned on a couple of occasions, Guide Dog Users Incorporated are celebrating their 30th anniversary luncheon, 30th anniversary this year, and they have a luncheon on today.
Audience left.
And it's fitting that they received the Distinguished Service Award on Sunday evening, the first session of the convention, for their Canine Connections program on September 11th. And the impact that that had on guide dogs, or really the impact that guide dogs had on the event in terms of assisting blind people. So that's a good 30th anniversary present for them, and they are an affiliate that really has embraced ACB Radio and are using it well. So they've got a luncheon to celebrate that 30th anniversary landmark this afternoon. Houston has a Holocaust Museum, and there will be a tour of that this afternoon. Tomorrow, there's another tour of the Houston Space Center. And for the first time ever, since I've been coming to ACB conventions, I've finally managed to get a bit of time, because I really do want to see the Houston Space Center.
Jonathan.
So, hi there.
This is Derek.
Hi, we're on the air. Derek, how are you?
I'm doing great. I didn't want to interrupt because you were doing so well.
Oh.
Did you say you were going to the Space Center?
Yeah, I got it. Are you going there too?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Oh, well, all I can say is, Houston, we have a problem.
That's right, no joke. You're rubbing it into those who don't or aren't able to go, or are you just simply...
I'm just saying, I've never been on a tour before at convention,
cool,
because I've generally been so busy.
You remember Jim mentioning last night at the Friends in Art thing about the mic clip and all that stuff?
Yes.
I'm wearing it, if you wouldn't...
Oh, no.
I wouldn't mind,
okay,
if you looked. It's on my... It's over my shoulders.
Okay,
things.
So what you've done here, you've got a modified coat hanger.
You see, it starts up there.
You're a tall young man, aren't you?
Yeah.
It starts
up there.
Oh, and it's stereo, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's
that's a Radio Shack mic clip. I took the stand part off.
Now, just let me just explain for people who are tuned in that this is Derek Lane. Now,
hello.
Derek, you've been helping out at the ACBRI booth, and we really appreciate that. And you're also a scholarship winner, so I'd like to know what your feeling is about the convention. How are you enjoying it?
I love every minute.
Yeah?
So far.
What is it about it that's really making you feel so good about it all?
It's the camaraderie of it all. Everybody, although everybody might not be the best of friends there, everybody comes together for this one thing, and I think all, you know, most disagreements and that kind of thing are just pretty much abandoned for this. And the fact that the environment is so friendly, where it is very impossible to get lost.
Yes.
I know I've been told that a lot before, and I'm like, well, you know, my luck, I'll get lost. Prove them all wrong, but I haven't so far.
No, and there's always a volunteer who's willing to assist, and
mm-hmm.
that makes a big difference. And, you know, there's something pretty special, isn't it, about a whole hotel being taken over by blind people like this.
Especially for my mom and especially my aunt, because they really had no clue what this was about and how, you know, needless to say, they've gotten a real eye-opener, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Looks like we're just about to convene with some door prizes shortly, but I'm just saying to the audience that I know you're doing lots of interviews over there, and we'd love to grab those and use them on main menu if you'd be agreeable.
If I put some together, we could call it sub-menu, couldn't we?
It's sub-menu. So go and get what you can for us. We appreciate it. It's lovely to speak with you, and I'm glad you're having such a good convention.
Now I got to find my seat again.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks.
See ya. That's Derek Lane, who's a scholarship winner. Very amiable young man, and I think he's going to go a long way. Let's go back to the convention now, where they're giving away door prizes.
Okay. Okay, we have two cards, one free dinner up to $8, two of them, from the Mission Burritos, and $20 from the Pennsylvania Council of the Blind. Deborah Lane, Morganton, North Carolina. Deborah? Okay, we'll try. Is Deborah here? No. Peggy Wildersen, Houston, Texas.
Good girl. Where's her chair?
Peggy Wildersen, Houston,
no,
Texas?
No. Oh, she's right.
I never heard of Sean Cox, Virginia. No, not here. Candace Stephan, Nacogdoches, Texas. Okay. Joy Francis, Redford, Michigan. Joy Francis, Michigan. Okay, next. Anybody in here? Call out a name. Alan Anthony, Raymore, Missouri.
Okay, let's move on, folks. Please take your seats.
Okay.
This morning we are honored to have with us, please.
This is
borrow the gavel. We need to move on. We have with us Ms. Robin Short. She's the Assistant Administrator of Elections in Harris County here in Houston. And she is going to talk to us about election reform in this area. I know that she has been working very closely with Doc Bradley to make voting accessible for all blind and visually impaired people in this area, and I would like now to ask Ms. Short to speak to us, and then we will hear from Melanie Brunson, our own governmental affairs representative, and take it away.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Robin Short. I'm the Assistant Administrator of Elections for Harris County, Texas. On behalf of Mrs. Kaufman, the County Clerk of Harris County, I would like to welcome y'all, and that's about as Texan as I get. I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri, the Show Me State. See, there you go. So even though I've lived in Texas for 16 years, I'm still considered by some a Yankee. So I'm still in the process of being reformed into a Texan myself. I'm excited and grateful that both Dr. Bradley and Mrs. Kaufman entrust me to speak to you today on election reform. I remember reading an article by Jim Dixon, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the American Association of People with Disabilities and Chair of the Disability Voter Project, where he at one time asked his wife to help cast his vote. After his wife cast his ballot, she said, "Jim, I knew that you loved me, but I know you trust me because you think I marked your ballot for that idiot." Now, we all know that women are usually correct in just about everything that they do. Now, don't get wild on me. But the point of the story is that there's always a level of uncertainty when another person marks your ballot for you. What Americans need is an accurate, effective, and accessible voting systems. Both the Senate and the House have introduced bills for election reform. The bills that I will touch on today are the ones most likely to be acted upon or have the greatest potential to be passed through and made into law. There is a House joint resolution introduced by Jean Green, a Democrat of Texas, which deals with the Electoral College. What this proposed amendment does is that it eliminates the Electoral College in favor of direct popular election of the president. So in other words, if the people sit there and elect a president, that's where it would stand. This has been referred to the House Judiciary Committee, and basically interest has declined, so it's sitting there. Nothing's happening on this at this time. The Senate Bill 154, introduced by Richard Shelby, Democrat of Alabama, amends to voting locations overseas and using our armed forces bases as an election polling place. That really hasn't gone very far either. It's kind of sitting out there waiting for someone to take action on it. The House Bill 50, introduced by Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, and the Senate Bill 50, introduced by Ted Stevens, Republican of Alaska, and Dan Inouye, Democrat of Hawaii. This is basically dealing with uniform polling location closings. And what they are stating is that they would like to establish a 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time as a deadline for polls to close. An alternative bill has been introduced by Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a Republican of Texas, which would set the time at 9 o'clock Central Standard Time. Both the House Committee on Energy and Commerce are holding hearings on this bill, and therefore neither one has taken direct action, so that's sitting there as well. It has not gone anywhere. John McCain, Republican of Arizona, and Tom Harkin, a Democrat of Iowa, have made mention of amendments to the Voting by Handicapped and Elderly Act. This is to ensure that voting at the polls and privacy for the blind and accessibility to the polling places are taken care of. Where this stands right now is that it has not been introduced as a bill. It is waiting until both the House Bill 3295 and the Senate Bill, Senate Bill 565 come to an agreement, and therefore that has not yet been done. So he's holding these amendments until a bill has been kind of settled between the House and the Senate. Senate Bill 27 basically deals with campaign finance reform. This bill would ban soft money and regulate campaign finance in a variety of ways. President Bush signed this bill into law on March 27th, and unfortunately, Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, has filed a suit challenging its constitutionality. So it's not really doing anything right. It's in law, but there is a lawsuit filed. House Bill 3295... introduced by Robert Ney, Republican of Ohio, and Steny Hoyer, Democrat of Maryland, is the Help America Vote Act. This creates new federal election agencies, election foundations, and it expands the federal role in elections through mandates, standards, grants, and recommendations. There is a $400 million buyout of punch card systems and a $2 million buyout basically in assisting states and entities in getting accessible voting machines. There are five versions of this bill, and right now the House of Representatives have passed the Help America Vote Act of 2001 this last December, and the bill is being sent to conference where it's expected to introduce new provisions to reconcile differences between the Senate Bill 565 and their House Bill 3295. The Senate Bill 565, introduced by Chris Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut, Mitch McConnell, a Republican of Kentucky, Schumer, a Democrat of New York, Torricelli, a Democrat of New Jersey, and Kit Bond, a Republican of Missouri. This is an election administration bipartisan bill, which creates new federal agencies, mandates many actions by the states, and places enforcement with the Department of Justice. It provides for $3.5 million in grants to the state and local governments over a five-year period. After adopting 40 amendments to this bill, the Senate, by a vote of 99-1, passed its version of election reform. A conference committee is expected to introduce new provisions to reconcile the differences between the Senate's bill and the House bill. So both these parties are trying to sit there and come together to come up with one bill that will sit there and actually help all disabled Americans and Americans in voting. Groups such as the AAPD, the American Association of People with Disabilities, the American Council of the Blind, and the Paralyzed Veterans of America are closely monitoring legislation that will affect the disabled community. The AAPD was established in 1995 with the goal of being a national voice for change in implementing the goals of the American with Disabilities Act. The AAPD, along with the ACB and 25 other national disability organizations, are opposed to the passage of House Bill 3295, arguing that the language in the bill is weak and that Congress must mandate stricter national standards that more clearly establish what is acceptable and what is not, stating that there have been voluntary standards for over 17 years, and in that time period, states and counties have not complied. In a survey last November of 100 counties, over 80% were still inaccessible. These groups have conveyed that they prefer the language in the bill authorized by Senators Dodd and Conyers, that's the Senate Bill 565, in that it clearly spells out what voting equipment must do and how polling places must operate. They feel that the bill does not limit its definition of the disabled to those with physical disabilities, but extends it to those who may have mental disabilities as well. The Constitution Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that seeks consensus on controversial constitutional and legal issues, as one of its four initiatives is election reform. In its forum on election reform, the ACB was brought in to voice its view. Although I don't need to inform you on your group's recommendations, I will read an excerpt from the report. If voting is to be truly accessible to persons who are either blind or have low vision, then the equipment necessary to accomplish this goal of a true ability to cast a secret ballot must be in place at polling sites. ACB strongly supports the use of direct recording equipment to ensure accessible, independent, secret and verifiable voting rights for the millions of blind or visually impaired citizens who only seek to exercise their franchise along with all other Americans. Direct recording equipment offers the advantage of maximum flexibility for future opportunities while costing less in the long run than optical scan devices. While passions are high in finding a resolution to these problems, everyone must work together in order for an election reform bill to pass. There are a number of states that have taken the lead in reform. I'm proud to say that Texas led the way in 1999 when the state legislature passed and then Governor Bush signed into law legislation that requires any new voting system purchased to be fully accessible to voters with disabilities, and the system must offer a secret and independent ballot to voters who are blind or who have low vision. The Secretary of State strongly encouraged voting system vendors to strive to develop systems that will provide a secret ballot for all individuals, but at the same time recognized that technology available at the time of the adoption was unable to accommodate voters who have no hearing or no vision. Here in Harris County, I'm proud to say that prior to 1999, Mrs. Kaufman, as county clerk, voluntarily met with the county attorney, representatives from Lighthouse for the Blind, a local law firm, and representatives from the Texas Civil Rights Council to accommodate a secret ballot for visually impaired voters. After several meetings, the only acceptable method appeared to be a tape-recorded ballot in which the voter would be instructed as to the mechanics of voting a punch card ballot and would be directed audibly to move the stylus or punching tool down the center of the ballot until touching the applicable hole that matched the voter's candidate or proposition of choice. Today, every polling site in Harris County is equipped with accessible voting machines. Harris County has purchased the eSlate voting system designed by Hart InterCivic, and with a purchase price of $25 million, Harris County is totally electronic. Other states have joined in by purchasing accessible voting machines and announcing projects and campaigns to help encourage disabled voters to vote. In May of this year, Iowa announced a campaign to increase voter turnout among the disabled by breaking down barriers. The Iowa Project has as its mission to increase turnout among the disabled by 65,000 this fall. In Indiana, the Count Us In Project is intended to educate public officials about the need for more accessible polls and to help people with disabilities to register and to get out and vote. While a great deal of work lies ahead, there is reason to be optimistic about the future. The American election system rests on the strong foundation of our nation's constitutional and statutory guarantees and the commitment of state and local election officials. That foundation, the special and expanding opportunities that modern technology provides, and importantly, an honest recognition of the challenges we face, combine to make the promise of reform bright. Now, Harris County has sat there and we have purchased a brand new electronic voting system. We will be, this November, it will be countywide. We have 884 voting precincts in Harris County, 750 which will be voting, actual voting locations. We will have a minimum of one, what's called a DAL unit, that's called the Disabled Access Unit, available in each precinct. That unit is an audio sound, and when you rotate the wheel, it will tell you what selection you have chosen. When you sit there and you hit the select button, it will tell you that you have made this selection. At the very end of the ballot, you can scroll through and it will tell you audibly which candidates you have chosen. Once you cast your ballot, it will tell you that your vote has been cast and thanks you for coming to the polls. We're very, very proud here in Harris County of the steps that Mrs. Kaufman has made and also all the work that Dr. Bradley has done with us so that we could move forward and we could make voting accessible to every individual in Harris County.
Services Administration. I agree with what Charlie said.
Does anybody have any questions on voting accessibility?
What we have to do is prepare people with...
Where can we see the voting machine?
Well, I do believe that there were a couple vendors that were here during your program, and they in the exhibit hall. I don't know if they are still there, but I do know that they were there. There are a lot of states that are now going out and purchasing new voting equipment, and I don't know if they do as what Harris County did, but Harris County sat there and made it accessible for all individuals to come and look at each system that was certified by the Secretary of State, and then they could give us their opinion of that voting device prior to our decision.
Madam Chairman,
yes.
Albert Anderson from Chicago. I understand that some of the latest voting technology even allows someone voting with the rotating dial system to write in a candidate if they want to do that. Can you explain how that's done, or am I incorrect?
No, for a write-in vote?
Yes.
Yes. Actually, what happens is that when there's a race and it states, it would come across the headphones that there's a write-in, that you can choose a write-in and you want to write in your own candidate. If you would hit enter, it would come up and you would spell the person's name out. And by spelling the person's name out in on our system, you would rotate the dial until you heard J for John, O for, you know, and you could actually spell out the person's name and then hit enter, and then that would be a write-in ballot. On others, there are touch screens, and theirs is basically done close to the same way.
Bonnie Newland, Golden Triangle Council of the Blind. We had an exhibit in November voting machines, and we requested 8 companies come, but only 2 showed up. How were you able to get as much of a response as you were able to make your selection?
Well, that's a very good question. Most states sit there and they have standards. In Texas, the Secretary of State actually has to inspect each voting system. It has to be brought before the Secretary of State, and they have to certify it. In other words, not just anyone can come into Texas and sell a voting system. It must meet all the criteria set forth by then Governor Bush and the Secretary of State to where it would meet the needs of handicapped and visually impaired individuals. Well, I think my time's up. So thank you all very much, and I hope you enjoy Houston.
Thank you very much. Melanie Brunson, who is the Governmental Affairs Coordinator for ACB, is going to talk to us now about accessible voting and the ACB issues. Melanie? Thank you, Robin. That was very interesting and informative.
Good morning. I, too, want to thank Robin for coming this morning. I think it's great when our local elections officials take the time to come to be with us. It's also kind of nice when they take the time to give part of my report. So since she actually did speak a lot about the national legislation, I'm going to just take a couple of minutes so that we can have time for questions to give you a little bit more of an update. First of all, as she indicated, ACB has been very involved in the discussions on the national level about the two bills, the primary bills that have moved through and have been passed by both the House and Senate. And we are currently in a conference committee. Conference committee has been appointed. The conference committee is in the middle of doing their business and has not finished doing it yet. And as of this point, we are supporting the Senate language, and we are encouraging members of the conference committee to support the Senate language. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Primarily, they are these. Both bills, the House bill and the Senate bill, indicate that one of the goals is to make the voting process accessible to people who need non-visual access. And they both say that that means that a person is to be able to cast a ballot in a manner that is independent, private, and verifiable, meaning that they can know whether the selection has been made that they intended to make. The difficulty arises in how that's done, because the Senate bill establishes a body which would then set up for nationwide standards, which would describe how that accessibility is to be provided. Whereas the House bill allows each state and each jurisdiction to determine that for themselves. And the requirement is only that they explain to the Justice Department the manner in which they intend to make voting accessible to people with disabilities, including people who are blind and visually impaired. So there is a chance of greater uniformity with the Senate language. The Senate language also includes a provision that accessibility measures need to be in place by 2006. What is probably going to be the next step after Congress returns from its July 4th recess is that there's going to be a move in the House. Representative Langevin from Rhode Island is a very active disability advocate. He happens to be a quadriplegic. And he is interested in making a motion that instructs the House members on the conference committee to support the accessibility language of the Senate bill. If he makes this motion, it will not apply to the deadline, the 2006 deadline, but it will apply to the requirement that non-visual access be included and that it doesn't limit it to physical disabilities, and it does indicate that accessibility is defined as allowing private, independent, and verifiable access. If he makes this motion, there will be a very short time in which members will have to vote on it. We think we are going to be able to be successful in getting that approved. If you have the opportunity when you get back, it would not hurt you, even if you don't know if they're members of the conference committee. I do believe I have a list of the members of the conference committee here, but we don't have time to read them all off. There's a bunch of them from the House. It would not hurt if anybody is interested in calling their House member to do so and to say simply, don't forget, the blind people are watching what happens in the House Conference Committee on Election Reform, and we support the Senate language. So that's one thing that we would encourage folks to do when you get back. The other thing I want you to know is that, and we will be reporting to you by every means possible as soon as there is any action on this, because the other thing that will come out of it is money for the states to use, which can provide, among other things, new means for them to make the election process accessible. And that's something that a lot of the states are waiting for is federal funds. The other thing I want you to know is that ACB is very close to having available an election reform advocacy handbook, which is very similar to our pedestrian safety handbook. And it's our hope that right after, fairly soon after the convention, we'll be able to give some information about how to get that. And it will contain really useful tools that you can use to work with your local elections officials to ensure that your when they make changes to their systems and when they buy new equipment, your voice is heard. So I think at this point I'm going to see if there's any questions for any remaining time that we might have available.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, Kim Ledford from Georgia. I had a situation last presidential election in my county, and I filed a complaint with the Department of Justice, and I'm still waiting to hear on whether they did an investigation or into the situation that I had, and I'm still waiting to hear from their decision or their findings and everything. And this was the last presidential election, and what can I do as a new first-timer and a new president of a local chapter?
Get in touch with me at the ACB National Office afterward. We might be able to help you make some contact with DOJ and find out the status of your complaint. You can call the national office, ask for me, and I'll be happy to help you investigate it. There have been a lot of difficulties with the mail to DOJ just since, and out of DOJ, quite honestly, since September 11th. And there were a number of complaints. There's also the possibility that it, because of backlogs in dealing with a lot of those issues, things got lost in the shuffle, but we may be able to track it down. Anyone else? Well, thank you all very much. Go out, advocate, and vote.
Thank you, Melanie. Okay, how many of you have read Harry Potter? Well, we have with us today Eric Sandvold, and he has been with the NLS Talking Book Program for 11 years. He has read all four Harry Potter books, as well as Chicken Soup for Kids' Soul, The Simpsons, Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus, and Dear Mr. Rogers. He has also read other periodicals such as National Geographic and People Magazine, Sports Illustrated. He's just a fine narrator, and we invite him to speak to us today.
Thank you very much. It's an unusual feeling for me to be here as a reader in front of all these eager, friendly faces. Normally I look out through the glass from the booth and I see one face that's sort of disconcerted, saying, "Oh no, what did I do to deserve working with Eric today? This is terrible." But this is a nice change of pace. And I don't know what you guys did to deserve me, but I'm very pleased to be here. It's really a unique pleasure for us to get a chance to meet you readers. It happens all too infrequently, and it really means a lot to us. What we do is a fairly solitary thing when we're actually doing the work. And so to actually get out and get to see the very people that we do the work for is very meaningful and is much appreciated. I have to start by saying I love my job. I've been doing it for 12 and a half years now, and I absolutely love reading talking books. There's some selfish reasons that I like it. One is that I love books myself, and I love to read, and I love to learn, especially getting to read some nonfiction and some periodicals. You kind of stay up on current events and know what's happening in the world and learn about things you otherwise would have no idea about. I love having the opportunity to use my voice and the performance skills that I've trained to acquire. Feels good as an actor to be able to actually put your skills to use and not only as saying, you know, what would you like to have with dessert today or something like that, but to actually be able to act. And another thing that's much appreciated is the many very good people that I get to work with. It's a group of people that are interested in the world, interested in books and learning, that are fun and entertaining, caring, and I'm very fortunate in working with who I do. And the main reason that I love my job is because of you, because it's an incredible feeling to know that the work we do is appreciated, that it's not just a way to earn a living, but that the effort that we put in and the work that we do is really listened to and is cared for. To know that... Your passion for books and for reading makes our work rewarding and really makes us feel that what we do matters. And that's a unique and not too common feeling, I think. And so I thank you very much for giving us that feeling. People who especially express their appreciation are kind of the link that lets us know that what we do matters. And it really is sustaining in those hours when you're sort of sludging your way through a book that maybe isn't your favorite or something like that, to remember those letters or the phone calls that certain people have taken an extra effort to make really sustains us, and we really appreciate that. That's the reminder that lets us know that we are appreciated and makes the whole work worthwhile. I think I had a special occasion happen last year that really hit home for me how much what we do is appreciated when I received the Scorby Award for Narrator of the Year for Fiction. And I really should be clapping for you and for whoever made that happen for me. Anybody that mentioned my name in conjunction with that or voted for me, and especially all the people at AFB who present the award. It's just, it was a magical weekend that my wife Martha and I will never forget. And it really meant a lot to me to be recognized for that. I really have made a point of putting a lot of effort into the work that I do, and it was very fulfilling for me. It also made me reflect upon the fact that really when I started off as a young professional, I was thought of myself primarily as an actor. And while I have done a lot of stage work and been privileged to do some on-camera stuff, I primarily really realized when I looked back that my job has been as a narrator, as a reader of talking books. And I was very proud to be able to call that my profession. I'm proud to be associated with this program. I am proud of the effort I've put forth in doing this work and proud of the work that I've done. And most of all, I'm really thankful for the many incredible people I've met, either you readers or the very fine people I've worked with over the years. That's made it incredibly rewarding. So how did this career in narration, in reading talking books begin? I guess you have to go back to when I was a little tyke. I was born in Boulder, Colorado, and I learned to read at the age of four. I'm a big sports fan, especially love football. And my dad had given me a book. All right. I've got Packers boxers on right now. Anyhow, I was given a book by my father called The Running Backs, and it was about all the great running backs of the past and had a lot of great color photos in there. And I wanted to know what it said in the captions under the photographs. And so I, as the story goes, taught myself to read so that I could read those. And I went on to be a favorite reader for my classmates in school. When there was a story to be read aloud, sometimes they'd say, "Teacher, can we have Eric read to us instead?" And I'd say, "Well, all right, what the heck? It's a lot of fun." So that should have told me I was on track for this. But the thing that was actually my first public audio recording, I think that happened in sixth grade when we were doing an Egypt unit, and we had to do a big project. So I chose for my Egypt project to be an interview with King Tut. And I sat upstairs in my bedroom, and I used a little audio cassette recorder, and I envisioned that I was a reporter, and I thought of what would be a cool name. And I had never seen this show, because I'm sure it was on after my bedtime, but you remember the old Robert Urich show, Vegas? Well, there was Dan Tanna. He was the but I didn't know, Tanna didn't make sense to me, so I thought his name was Dan Tanner. And I decided I would be Dan Tanner, and I'd be investigating the pyramids. And this is how the story went on the tape. And I went in, and sure enough, as I'm looking at these crypts and vaults, King Tut arises from the dead, and I interview him. And this was my first recording. It was all improvised based on some facts that I had read and had to put in for the scholastic value of the project. And I remember one particularly embarrassing part of this, which was when I asked, in the form of Dan Tanner, asked King Tut about his love life, and he sort of wistfully said, "Ah, yes, I had a wife. Her name was Nefertiti. And she was very beautiful." And I remember being embarrassed when I said it, and even more embarrassed to realize I didn't have time to go back and re-record it. And then as it went, this recording became very popular in the school library, especially with the younger grades. And the kids would say, "I want to use my library time to listen to that King Tut interview." And I knew that every day they had to hear that, "Very beautiful." And I was just mortified. But nonetheless, I guess, I should have taken it as a sign that I had some destiny, some calling in this respect, because the kids liked the tape, and so people liked hearing my voice on tape, even back then. In the next few years, I really developed a love of acting, and that led me to Northwestern University, where I was a theater major. It was a wonderful experience there. And even though I was a theater major, this is really my wife's story to tell, because she was a performance studies major, or as they called it when she was there, the oral interpretation department. But or also, as it was nicknamed, the Department of Reading Out Loud. That's what the theater majors called it. Yeah, she just gave me a scolding finger. That's her, because she was a major, but I was a theater major. I was an outsider. But it was my classes that I took in that department that really also inspired me in this realm. Northwestern is sort of the cradle of the performance of literature in other ways, not just being read, off the page, but being brought to life in other ways. And so the passion that was instilled in me by great professors like Frank Galati, who's won a Tony Award for Best Play for Grapes of Wrath, and for also for directing that play, and Mary Zimmerman, who just won a Tony Award for her direction of Metamorphoses on Broadway. These were the sort of people that were there bringing their passion and sharing it with us. And that I think took me that last final step toward this job. After I graduated from Northwestern, I was living in Washington, D.C. with my aunt and uncle and my cousins. They'd invited me to come start my young career there. And there was a thing called the Actors Center, which was provided resources for young actors in Washington, D.C. And they had a hotline which told you about auditions or jobs that were related to theater, that sort of thing. And in listening to that hotline, one day I heard that there were auditions at the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped for three new narrators that they needed for their studio. And I thought, I hadn't really given much thought to that before. I don't think that books on tape, even in any realm, were that familiar to me at that point. But all of a sudden I thought, well, that just sounds perfect. I would love to do that. So I made an appointment to audition, and I think I had an audition for some sort of like commercial or something come up, like a coffee commercial in Baltimore or something. So I had to cancel and reschedule. And then the next time I was coming back from some other audition for theater, because that was where my focus was at that point, and I got stuck in traffic, and I had to call again and say, I'm just stuck in this traffic jam. Please don't hate me, but, I really want to still audition. And luckily they took me, and I thought, I don't stand a chance. They think I'm a flake. Forget it. But I went in and I read for the director at that time, whose name was Hal Schneider. And I remember one thing about my audition. I read a passage from Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities. And I was a West kid from Colorado, and I didn't know much about the East Coast, so I came to the part where it talked about Bedford Stuyvesant. And I think it was like some cops, some Brooklyn cops talking about it. And I had one of my cops say, "Yeah, over at Bedford Stuyvesant." And so he kindly corrected me that it was Bedford Stuyvesant, and I kind of sheepishly said, "Thanks, yeah." But despite that gaffe, I was one of three fortunate people to be hired out of about 50 auditionees, and my reading career began. I have such fond memories of that first year. I was only in Washington, D.C. for 1 year, but it really made me love this job. And it's a neat circumstance there. They have the booths off to one side. It's changed a little since I've been there, but at that time there were all the booths off to one side, and then there was sort of a general room where the researchers did their research and where we would always take our breaks. And it just became this wonderful forum for discussion and support, and it was a wonderful environment. I have great memories of David Impastato and Hal Schneider, Reggie Metcalf, Barbara Caruso, Grover Gardner, Laura Gianarelli, and the inimitable Ray Hagen, who I think is best summed up. One time I was telling a story from my childhood about clowns or something, and he sort of turned away in disgust and made a sour face and mumbled under his breath, "I hate clowns." That's Ray pretty much for you. And then most of all, and most fondly, I think I recall John Reed, who I hope some of you remember as well. He's no longer with us, but he was so very supportive of me as a young actor starting out, and most especially as a young narrator. And we shared together a love of perfect corrections. As you all probably know, we make a lot of mistakes in what we do, and there's a lot of stopping and starting and going back. And any of the mistakes that we don't catch the first time around come back to us from the auditors, who say, "Oh, you missed this, and you've got to drop in this sentence again and say the word correctly or put this word back in." Well, that's not so easy, but it's a lot of fun. And it is one of the few things. People say, nothing's perfect. Well, you can do, let me tell you, a perfect correction where people really can't tell. It doesn't happen all the time, but when you really nail it and it just fits in perfectly and the tone is right and your voice is right and the volume's right and everything works, you've actually achieved perfection. And so John and I would get downright giddy when that would happen. And I so fondly remember that. And the other thing he did for me, which was very important, I think, in my being able to continue to do this, was he told me when I was going to go to Denver for a short while, and then I was planning on coming back to D.C., he sat me down and he said, don't feel obligated. I know you really appreciate the fact that you were hired here. He said, but don't feel obligated to come back. He said, you've given us as much as we've given you, and you're young, and you've got a lot of choices ahead of you. Make the decision that's best for you. And I think that gave me permission to do that, which ended up leading me to Denver and to being able to do this job for a longer time, I think, as a result. So I really am very thankful to John. At the DC studio, that's where I learned how to read. And I learned in the what I call the old style of rather sort of subdued, you know, more letting you guys do the reading and keeping the performance energy reined in quite a bit. And that was a little tough for me at first, being a young actor that wanted to show off what I could do and all that kind of stuff. It was hard to rein me in. But they started me off with Americans with Disabilities Act. yeah. They were recording it as a favor, as a sort of a thank you gift to a lot of the people that had helped prepare it. And I think maybe they were trying to get rid of me because it was needless to say, while it's a wonderful piece of legislation, it was dry and just Byzantine with the legalese. I was absolutely tortured by it, but fascinated nonetheless, and it actually made me come back for more. I loved the challenge, so their plot didn't work, and I stayed on. And I think that it was a learning process over that first year of really learning to read in the way that NLS wanted us to narrate. Then I moved to Denver, thinking it was temporary. I was with a theater company in Washington that went belly up, and we had done a production of Oedipus the King, which was right after the big Marion Barry scandal. And so the idea was it was a Marion Barry Oedipus, which probably was not that bad an idea, except for the fact that it was in a theater in Washington, D.C., in the summer that was not air-conditioned. And it was very uncomfortable, to say the least. And they had really banked everything on their ticket sales, and so they didn't get any because nobody wanted to sit there in the summer. And this theater company, who had kind of cast me for their whole season, went under, leaving me therefore with no work for the fall. So I thought, oh, I'll go back to Colorado. And I ended up playing King Arthur in a production of Camelot, thinking I would go right back to D.C. But when I was back in Colorado, I realized the theater scene there was nice. It had changed a lot in the 5 years I'd been gone, and there was a lot of opportunity as a theater actor. And best of all, they had a talking book studio, so I could keep doing this work that I'd come to love. So I decided to stay in Colorado. Well, for the meantime, I still kind of had my sights set on some acting goals. And I was about to move to L.A. for the summer to do a Shakespeare Festival in Orange County. But when that fell through, I was led to a fateful audition. It was in Boulder, Colorado, at a home. It was for the Boulder Repertory Company and their production of The Film Society by John Robin Bates. And I went and I read for this lead character, and I guess they liked my reading, so they said, yeah, we want to hear you read something else. But first we're going to have one of Denver's finest older actresses come read for the part of your mother. So would you please send her down, and you go upstairs and look this next scene over? I said, fine. And on my way up the stairs, this woman was already coming down, and I thought to myself, you know, I don't know about what the Oedipal implications were or whatever, but I thought, you know, she does not look like an older actress to me, and I don't really care if she is, because she is fine. And that turned out to be Martha Harmon Pardee. And as soon as she walked into the room, they realized she can't be his mother. I mean, they made some mistake, and they ended up hearing how talented she was. They cast her as a character that was my friend, my peer, and we got to be in the show together. That's how we met. My thinking, I was sending down a person to be my mother. So in that process, I realized what a talented actress she was, but we were both so busy that we didn't get to know each other until a couple weeks into the show, and we were at a cast party. We'd both been in these long other relationships, both of which had just ended, and so all the stars aligned, and we had our first date after an evening recording session at Tongue Books, actually. I went on over to her apartment, And when I learned how smart and funny and charming and caring and brave, can you tell I'm smitten? that she was, you know, then I fell swiftly and deeply in love, and I have been ever since. And you know, if you think she's a talented narrator, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. She's a great mother, and she's a wonderful cook, and she's much better at fixing things around the house than I am. She's saying stop it to me, but she's amazing. And so she had just come from Los Angeles, and I thought, and I kind of heard some of her stories. She'd had a mostly rotten time there and didn't really want to return. And so I decided to focus on Denver and wanted to be near her. And that kept me at Talking Books, which I'm very thankful for, and kept us together. We've been married for 9 years almost. And we have two wonderful daughters. Our oldest is Addie. She's 6, and she's already reading like crazy. And Helena is 4, and she's the family entertainer and comedian. So I think they're definitely already taking after their parents. I wish you could meet them, but you'll have to just make do with us for the time being. And if I talk about them anymore, I'm going to just leave and rush back off to Colorado to go see them because I miss them so much. But I'll stay here and finish. Back to Talking Books. A little look behind the scenes. A lot's happened in the 11 and a half years that I've been there. One of the things that is a major change is the style has shifted, or did many years ago, from that style where we sort of pulled back as narrator and allowed the readers to do the reading for themselves to a little bit more performing style, a little bit more animated style. And that was an interesting switch for me. You know, I know it's an issue that people have different feelings about, and for me, it was hard because I had worked so hard to break myself of those performing habits. Now all of a sudden they're saying, no, ramp it back up and do this stuff. And it was very difficult for me. It actually, I think, took me close to 2 years to really fully make that switch to the way that NLS wanted me to. They kept nudging me. I'd sort of do a little more, and they'd say, it's a little better, but come on, go for it, buddy. And then I'd do a little more. I'd think, oh, that's too much. And then they'd say, no, more, more, more. So finally, when I gave myself over to it, it was a very good thing for me. I really enjoyed it. I think it was... it allowed me to really use some of the things I do best more fully, and I think it fit a lot of the material that I read well, especially the fantasy and science fiction stuff, where I think the extreme voices, something like Harry Potter, where you can really give color to a lot of different characters, is more fun that way. And I also think, in a lot of ways, especially with big works of fiction where there are so many characters, it helps to have that wider range to delineate the characters and set them apart more so that it's clearer to understand who's who. I'm going to go ahead and read a little Harry Potter right here, I think, just seeing as we're talking about it. And some of you may have actually heard this section before, but... I always enjoy it. Little action sequence here. Toward the end of the first book. I hate to read from the later books in case people haven't read them yet, and I really do recommend everybody read them because they're wonderful, but I don't want to give away, you know, the secret. So, from the first book, The Sorcerer's Stone. Harry felt as if Devil's Snare was rooting him to the spot. He couldn't move a muscle. Petrified, he watched as Quirrell reached up and began to unwrap his turban. What was going on? The turban fell away. Quirrell's head looked strangely small without it. Then he turned slowly on the spot. Harry would have screamed, but he couldn't make a sound. Where there should have been a back to Quirrell's head, there was a face. The most terrible face Harry had ever seen. It was chalk white, with glaring red eyes and slits for nostrils like a snake. Harry Potter, it whispered. Harry tried to take a step backward, but his legs wouldn't move. See what I have become, the face said. Mere shadow and vapor, I have form only when I can share another's body. But there have always been those willing to let me into their hearts and minds. Unicorn blood has strengthened me these past weeks. You saw faithful Quirrell drinking it for me in the forest. And once I have the elixir of life, I will be able to create a body of my own. Now, why don't you give me that stone in your pocket? So he knew. The feeling suddenly surged back into Harry's legs. He stumbled backward. Don't be a fool, snarled the face. Better save your own life and join me, or you'll meet the same end as your parents. They died begging me for mercy. Liar! Harry shouted suddenly. Quirrell was walking back at him so that Voldemort could still see him. The evil face was now smiling. How touching, it hissed. I always value bravery. Yes, boy, your parents were brave. I killed your father first, and he put up a courageous fight. But your mother needn't have died. She was trying to protect you. Now give me the stone, unless you want her to have died in vain. Never! Harry sprang toward the flame door, but Voldemort screamed, Seize him! And the next second, Harry felt Quirrell's hand close on his wrist. At once, a needle-sharp pain seared across Harry's scar. His head felt as though it was about to split in two. He yelled, struggling with all his might. And to his surprise, Quirrell let go of him. The pain in his head lessened. He looked around wildly to see where Quirrell had gone and saw him hunched in pain, looking at his fingers. They were blistering before his eyes. Seize him! Seize him! Shrieked Voldemort again, and Quirrell lunged, knocking Harry clean off his feet, landing on top of him, both hands around Harry's neck. Harry's scar was almost blinding him with pain, yet he could see Quirrell howling in agony. Master, I cannot hold him in my hands! My hands! And Quirrell, though pinning Harry to the ground with his knees, let go of his neck and stared bewildered at his own palms. Harry could see they looked burned, raw, red, and shiny. Then kill him, fool, and be done! Screeched Voldemort. Quirrell raised his hand to perform a deadly curse, but Harry, by instinct, reached up and grabbed Quirrell's face. Quirrell rolled off him, his face blistering too. And then Harry knew. Quirrell couldn't touch his bare skin, not without suffering terrible pain. His only chance was to keep hold of Quirrell, keep him in enough pain to stop him from doing a curse. Harry jumped to his feet, caught Quirrell by the arm, and hung on as tight as he could. Quirrell screamed and tried to throw Harry off. The pain in Harry's head was building. He couldn't see. He could only hear Quirrell's terrible shrieks and Voldemort's yells of, Kill him! Kill him! And other voices, maybe in Harry's own head, crying, Harry! Harry! He felt Quirrell's arm wrenched from his grasp, knew all was lost, and fell into blackness. Down. 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 Something gold was glinting just above him. The snitch. He tried to catch it, but his arms were too heavy. He blinked. It wasn't the snitch at all. It was a pair of glasses. How strange. He blinked again. The smiling face of Albus Dumbledore swam into view above him. Good afternoon, Harry, said Dumbledore. Harry stared at him. Then he remembered. Sir, the stone. It was Quirrell. He's got the stone. Sir, quick. Calm yourself, dear boy. You are a little behind the times, said Dumbledore. Quirrell does not have the stone.
Then who does? Sir, I...
Harry, please relax. Man Pumphrey will have me thrown out. Harry swallowed and looked around him. He realized he must be in the hospital wing. He was lying in a bed with white linen sheets, and next to him was a table piled high with what looked like half the candy shop. "Tokens from your friends and admirers," said Dumbledore, beaming. "What happened down in the dungeons between you and Professor Quirrell is a complete secret. So naturally, the whole school knows. I believe your friends, Misters Fred and George Weasley, were responsible for trying to send you a toilet seat. No doubt they thought it would amuse you. Madame Pumphrey, however, felt it might not be very hygienic and confiscated it." End of side three. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I still have a little time left, so I can give you a little more behind-the-scenes info if you'd like. What was that? Oh, the sorting hat. That would be fun. Well, what I thought I would do, I get to speak again at the Lua gathering, so if you want a little bit more reading, there's going to be a lot more at that later this afternoon. I don't have a good spot. The sorting hat's a great idea, but I don't have it marked, and probably by the time I found it, the time would be over. A little bit more behind-the-scenes stuff at Talking Books. I'm known as being a perfectionist at work, which is probably why those monitors look at me and say, "Not Eric, not today." I have this tendency to stop and listen to make sure a voice sounds right. Like, was that really what Dumbledore sounds like? I have a feeling it wasn't quite right, and I'll have people play it back and do it again. Or I'll say, "I don't know if I really got that sentence just right. Would you play that back for me?" And so the monitor will sort of go, "Okay, whatever, it sounded fine, but yep, sure." And that sounds very responsible of me, but I think it's really more just neurotic. The look is usually either bemused, like, you know, here he goes again, or it's confused, like, what the heck is he thinking? I mean, that was fine. What are you doing? Or this sort of indulgent look, you know, like, well, it's Eric, so yeah, you know, we'll be treading water here for a while. And some of them finally get firm with me and just say, "It's fine, we're going on, let's go, come on." And the thing is, other narrators manage to read beautifully without all that Sturm und Drang. I like to say that some of the people, Martha is definitely one, Bill Wallace is another, they're time machines. They can just read and read and read, they don't make mistakes. And Martha, for instance, routinely will read over 300 minutes in a day if she works all day, whereas, and her average is probably over 250, and that's my best ever. She averages what my very best is, you know. Just a better ability to concentrate and focus over long periods of time, I think. I am very hard on myself when I read. I kind of beat myself up a lot. But it's a nice welcome thing when I get to have monitors that I really trust to work with, where I can bounce ideas off and really say, you know, how was that? And if there's a few people I trust so much that if they say, it was good, then I go on. Sometimes I have to listen for myself to be sure. One other thing we battle sometimes in the booth is that it's dark in there. We usually choose to have all the lights off but a reading lamp just so we focus on the page. And it also can be kind of hot, especially in the summer. At Talking Books, we used to have a pair of booths in a different building, and often the air conditioning was broken in that building. And these booths had particularly poor ventilation, so it would really get like into the high 80s and stuff in the booths without much air movement. And one night, it was, I think, a Friday night. I used to read People on Friday evenings. It was kind of a nice thing, kind of read some pop culture stuff on a Friday night. And I was with her. We were the only people over in this other building. It was very hot. I was pouring sweat. And so I said to my monitor, who was a good friend, I said, do you mind if I like just take my shirt off? I know it's kind of weird, but to take my shirt off, just pour some water on myself. I'm really burning up in here. And they said, oh, sure, you know, it's just the two of us, no problem. Well, I'm sitting there reading for a while, and about 10, 20 minutes later, what should happen, but a good friend of mine, Jim Hermanson, had a visitor come over who had from some other part of the country who had wanted to see our studio. This is at about you know, 8:30 on a Friday night. What are the chances of this? We get about one visitor every few months, you know. And here Jim sort of happily and proudly leads this person into view, and they just sort of stop short as they peer into the booth, and they see this man, because we're cut out, you can only see what's above the table. So I appeared, for all intents and purposes, to be totally naked, just happily reading away. And there was just this look of dumbfounded just awkwardness. You know, what is going on here? And we had to sort of haltingly, you know, explain that it was so hot and I really had pants on, you know. But anyway, it was a funny occurrence. One of the favorite stories around talking books. And one of the other things that can happen a lot of times is you can get the giggles. I remember Claudia Frisbee, who's the wonderful woman who's responsible for working out the schedule, which is always changing at Talking Books. A long time ago, she and I were reading a list of recipes for good housekeeping. And for whatever reason, that month, they were focusing on variations on meatloaf. And so I had to keep saying the word loaf. Which, like when you write your own name too many times, you know, it gets kind of silly. And so by about the 18th time that I said the word loaf, I just couldn't say it anymore without completely breaking down into fits of giggles. And I think to read this, you know, list of recipes, it was about 5 minutes total reading time. It probably took us half an hour because we just couldn't stop laughing. And then, of course, the other thing that can happen is you can get really caught up in a story and I'm sort of a sentimental softie myself, so that's not an unusual occurrence for me, especially at the end of a book about a pet or something like that. And if the monitor hasn't been a part of the entire story, they can kind of, you know, give you that look like, you know, pull yourself together, man. What are you doing? You know, because to them, they just came in on the last part of the story. They don't, you know, they haven't been tied up with it. But then there are other wonderful occasions where if you work on like a long fantasy series or something. One time I did this long series of Tad Williams books, and it was a grand total of about 3,000 pages, I think. And we really came to love these characters, and I'd only worked with about three different monitors, so they all knew the story very well. And then when you get to those, the deaths of some of these key characters and stuff, you know, you're both sobbing and consoling each other. That's actually a really wonderful occurrence, even though it's kind of painful because you can't get any work done. You know, you keep trying to open your mouth and... But I think that my time is nearly up, so I just wanted to say that there are really so many people involved in bringing Talking Books to you and in the recording of them that with the I'm aware of course. And so on behalf of all of the monitors that I work with and the many fine auditors who used to be monitors and have graduated on, and the researchers who tell us how to say things, the executives like Rudy Savage and Jane Maxwell and Claudia Frisbee, and the many narrators that you're familiar with, including our good friend Kristen Allison, who our girls call Binks. From all of us, we just really want to thank you. And thank you for having me here as their representative and for sharing your love of books with us and allowing us to share our love of books with you. Thank you very, very much.
Well, I have just one word. Yes! Thank you so much. That was great. That's great. We have reached the end of our session for Wednesday, and I'm going to turn the program back over to our president. I thank you for coming and listening and participating and allowing me to preside over this session. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we were talking about the convention schedule and who was going to do what and if we were going to have officers presiding and so on, Donna said to me, Chris, do I really have to do this? I said, well, you don't have to do it, but I think you should. People would like to get to know you. She says, oh, I don't know. I just don't know if I can do this. I think she did great. What do you guys think? We might even bring her back next year.
Mr. President?
Mr. President, I have announcements.
I have an announcement also, sir.
Okay. Pat, what's your announcement?
Just very quickly, LUA needs to have its business meeting for a very brief time at the break in the Braille LUA session this afternoon. We need to vote on our bylaws amendments.
Okay, thank you. I would now like to recognize Cynthia Towers for some announcements. Cynthia?
All right. Those of you who are going on the tour and those of you who are not going on any tours, please listen to this announcement. We have set up a modified quick meal section where you did your pre-registration that is and we'll ask you for your ticket if you insist. That's only to help the people going on tours to get their box lunch, to get their sandwich, and to get on the bus. Please, if you're not going on a tour, if you're just hanging, please don't go through that line and insist you get a sandwich. Okay? It's for today and tomorrow. You're going to walk right out and see sandwiches and go, ooh! So please, they're so close! go to the regular quick meal section unless you're the tour people. Tour people, you can go through that line, get your exact change is appreciated, have your $6 ready. All right, caucuses. Wisconsin will caucus in 6:39. Room 6:39 at 5 p.m. Arkansas will caucus, and that is today. Also today, Arkansas will caucus in their delegation following the close of this session. Also today, Old Dominion will caucus in their delegation following the close of this session. Finally today, Texas will caucus in room 977. Tomorrow caucuses, Missouri at 1:30 in room 1068. Hope that's 1:30 p.m. California. Richmond, 1 and 2 at 7 a.m. Oh, my God. Turn my... beg your pardon? I can't hear you. If there is a correct... All right. Well, just
Richmond
go to...
Richmond, 2 and 3.
Just go to 2. You'll hit it. All right. 7 a.m., Washington Council of the Blind.
That's right.
Save me a plate. I may be there late, but I'll be there. In Briar Park, 2 and 3. Ohio, caucus breakfast in Richmond, 1. Let me see. Bay State and New England affiliates will caucus in the Diplomat Room tomorrow following this session. Iowa will be tomorrow, 7:30 a.m. in room 703. Nebraska, Thursday from 1 to 3 in Rose Garden. If you the recreation zone is featuring water aerobics and beep baseball, so go check out the recreation zone. Colorado, caucus tomorrow, 7 a.m. in room 375. 374. All righty. Thank you. Let me see. Oh, tables are going fast for the banquet. There are 60 tables. All but about 12 of them have been reserved. So if you want a banquet table to sit with some friends, and you need to go at 3 p.m. by 3 p.m. tomorrow, go to reserve your table. I'm assuming that President Gray has talked to you about the dinner with our representative from the People's Republic of China. We still have several tickets left for that. That is this evening, 7 p.m., $30. So please take advantage of that, and that will be at the Hilton. Let me see. This is the last day for the quilt, and so make sure that you get your tickets for that. Oh, and there is a real exciting thing happening with regard to the new affiliate. The new affiliate forming is, let me get this name correct, the Associated Blind of Industrial Development and Equality, or ABIB. And there's going to be a meeting today in A at 3:30. Industrial employees, staff, service consultants, or interested parties just want to know what's going on in the world of industrial workers, go to A today at 3:30. Guide dog lunch will be in the foyer, and North Carolina will caucus Thursday after the session in their delegation. I believe, now let me look at this little scrappy, see I've got my own little scrappy scrappies here. I believe that is it, Mr. President.
Okay, thank you very much, Cynthia. There's been a request of information about the president's meeting, and we'll look that up here, so don't go away too fast. It's, as I remember, it's at 1 o'clock. Oh, 3 o'clock. Okay, okay. Let's not get too upset about these things, folks. We'll work them out, okay? Now, who's the gentleman calling for the floor?
It's Ray Campbell of Illinois.
Okay.
There we go. I just wanted to ask a question. Ralph's committee's done a great job getting us the media exposure, but when a lot of these interviews and stuff are taking place, a lot of us have other things to do. Would it be possible to get some videos of these interviews and that have been done and have a viewing session sometime before the end of the convention for those that are interested that could attend and just see what our people are really saying about us? And stuff?
To be honest, Ray, I sincerely doubt if we can do that. It's a heck of a good idea. We can put it on the schedule for next year. I'll talk to Ralph about it, but I don't see that it's going to be very easy to do that. We'll talk about it.
Suggestion.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The president's meeting is at 3 o'clock.
Where?
In the front pavilion. In the front pavilion. Cynthia, it's just outside of exhibits, if that helps you. Just outside the exhibit room.
Mr. President?
Yes, who calls for the floor?
This is Patty Cox from Kentucky.
Yes, Patty.
We have one Holocaust ticket to sell if anyone wants it. I will be in the back of the room.
Okay. What ticket?
Mr. President.
Holocaust tour.
Okay, great. Ed Bradley, how about some door prizes?
Yes, before we do door prizes, we have two tickets for the coming up tour to the Holocaust to give away right here if somebody wants.
Margarine
has them. Okay. And now, ready for door prizes.
Ready for door prizes.
Mr. Bradley?
Yes.
This is Ms. Towers. May I jump in really? Just to let people know that the we guaranteed so many people to go to the Chinese dinner. They cannot cut it down too far. We're going to have to pay for these dinners whether we eat them or not. So I really encourage you to go across the hall and buy a ticket so that we can have a dinner with our Chinese delegation. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. And remember, do that by 2 o'clock today. Do it by 2 o'clock today.
Okay, since we couldn't give them away a while ago, we have two Mission Burrito dinners, Pennsylvania Council of the Blind, $20, and we're going to give away buy one, get one free Indian dinner. Donna Pomerantz. Next.
I can't believe
here?
They're not here.
Thank you.
She is here.
Okay, we have $25 from RSVA and Tandoor Indian dinner. Just a moment. Randolph Green. Good, we got it.
Okay.
Austin, Texas. Okay, we have $25 from the Alabama. I know the difference. And from Subway. Give me a name. Nancy Unger, Riverside, California. Nancy here? No. Okay. How about Rochelle Preston, Cerritos, California? Yeah, I don't know. Elizabeth Lennon, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Elizabeth? Stay, she's here. Somebody, she got that lady over there.
Let's do one more and then we'll have to quit.
Okay, we have $50 from the Illinois Council of the Blind. I'll get it in a minute, just a second. Barry Levine. Palmer Glenn. Barry Levine. Yeah, give me one more. Melvin Smith, Kansas City, Missouri. Here, that goes to him. Okay, that's
it. I sure
it.
Hope he's here.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Wednesday session. We are now adjourned.
And that concludes our coverage of today's general session of the 41st Annual Convention of the American Council of the Blind. We will be back at 8 o'clock Central tomorrow morning. That is 1300 Universal Time. And it also equates to 9 Eastern and something dreadful like 6 Pacific in the AM. Thank you for joining us and for your emails and MSN messages. And goodbye from Houston for today.